get out of the other room.
I can't even, like, figure out. It's like,
there you go.
Oh, I'll sit Indian style. She was saying right here, Chris, that that was your seat.
All right. Okay.
I know.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. I apologize for my voice. It is different for those who have heard me before, but it's better than it was yesterday.
Okay, that's the record.
No.
Today we will begin at approximately 1:20 on Senate Bill 555, and that'll take the rest of the afternoon. The other bills that are listed, you note that the heading says the following bills will be heard to meet the Senate first hearing deadline. And what that means is it's our traditional tap-tap hearing. We don't plan on taking testimony on those bills today. It just means that the chair and the committee have an interest in those bills, and we'll probably bring them back later in the next 2 weeks for a public hearing and work session. So this will seem strange to you as far as if you're not familiar with it on how our democracy works, but here we go. The chair will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 934. The chair will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 934. The chair will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 531. The chair will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 531. The chair will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1168 and likewise close the public hearing on the same. The chair will open public hearing on Senate Bill 65. The chair closes the public hearing on Senate Bill 65. The chair will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1304. The chair will close the public hearing on 1304. The chair will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1066. The chair closes the public hearing on 1066. The chair will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1207. The chair closes the public hearing on 1207. Oh, I do. The chair will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 944. Ingrid, would you mind waiting for your testimony? Thank you. The chair will close the public testimony on 944. The chair will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 75775. Ed Allen, will you mind holding your testimony until we're ready to hear the bill? Ed? Well, you're willing to come back later?
I will certainly do so.
Thank you. That's a good move, Ed. the chair will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 775. The chair opens the public hearing on Senate Bill 1210. Jack Monroe. Jack was here a moment ago. See how perceptive Jack is. The chair will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1210. The chair opens the Senate hearing on Senate Bill 456. Charlie Williamson. He was here a moment. Okay, he doesn't need to.
No.
We'll invite him back on another day.
Yeah.
The chair will close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 456. That then brings us to Senate Bill 555, and I'll open the public hearing on that. Let me explain to you what the process will be today and why this bill is before us. The bill initially was a Mayee bill, Senator Mayee, dealing with detention of youth who were caught with firearms at schools. We put that the body of that bill into another bill called 344, which will be on the floor of the Senate on Monday. So we've handled that issue. But the beauty of Senate Bill 555 is it had this wonderful relating clause. It said relating to juveniles. So that gives us the discretion of putting anything we want in that bill relating to juveniles.
Called gut and stuff.
That's called the gut and stuff. And Senator Mayee has graciously allowed us to do that with her bill. So today we are going to gut and stuff. And what I have requested and from the governor's staff and Pam Curtis and Steve Marks have provided is their initial thoughts on what Senate Bill 555 should look like as it relates to juvenile justice. And those will be presented to us in the Dash 3 amendments, correct? And then there'll be other discussions and other amendments that we will cover in our public testimony today. We will not work the bill today. We expect to be overloaded with information. but the bill will be worked in the next 8 to 10 days. And the focus today will primarily be on the juvenile justice and the older at-risk juveniles. But I wanted to point out to the members of the audience and, of course, and remind the committee that when we began the session in January, we spent the first 3 days on juvenile justice, and that included not only the at-risk kids who were older, but also we had experts come in from around the country to talk about early intervention and prevention. And I'll just remind the committee, we had Roxanne Lead from Washington State on their policy and institute public policy. And she concentrated on what the state of Washington does to make sure when they have a program and they spend the money that they can measure the goal, much like Jeff Ryan's going to talk about on our progress board. We had Michael Schumacher, Chief Probation Officer from Orange County, California, and they've had a very successful high-risk teenage adult offender program. And so we know that program is one that works, and the governor's program incorporates some of that. We had Clay Yeager from Pennsylvania, and it's their governor's community partnership for safe children. And he concentrated on the 10 programs that we know work through a study done by the University of Colorado at Boulder. We had Linda Wagner from Lane County Youth Services talk about Lane County. We had Robin Carr Morse, who is a nationally recognized Oregonian on early childhood brain development, and she's attended several White House conferences, and they're going to design a national program over her book. And she was very good on what you can do from the very beginning, pre-birth. We had Scott Johnson and Dennis Maloney and others from Deschutes County, children and families dealing with how that county in Oregon is trying to address the issue. And then we had a presentation from Oregon's High-Risk Criminal Crime Reduction Partnership. And that seems like a long time ago that we did those things. But everyone in the committee was interested in addressing the subject. And so approximately 3 weeks ago, I scheduled this bill, and intending to have us in the Senate work through this process. And we intend to do that. What happened in Colorado, it's a somber and tragic experience, and it can't help but affect our emotions and our decisions as we ponder these issues. But I want to assure everyone we would have done this bill without that occurring. And, of course, we have our own Thurston instance that we are also trying to address, and these are one of the small but significant steps that can do that. In the Hillcrest situation and the suicides. The bill that comes from your Senate Judiciary on Monday deals with the 72-hour mandatory detention and psychological evaluation before you're released. And I expect that to pass the Senate with overwhelming support on Monday. So that's another step that we took. Earlier we passed a bill that allows school districts to exchange information with juvenile departments and courts. There were some roadblocks because of confidentiality and other things, and so we did what we could in that area, and that should be of assistance. But to a large extent, the responsibility is going to be yours, because this is a parental, it's a communal, it's a school district, it's what you want to do where you live, and we can help and we can facilitate, but don't let us assume the responsibility for solving the problem. And unfortunately, this is more of a generational problem. There is no quick fix. But today we're going to begin that process. The first hour and 15 minutes to an hour will be come from Governor Kitzhaber and his staff and the people that have been working on this subject for the past year. Excuse me. Then we'll have additional public testimony. We do have sign-up sheets. There will be senators and representatives that will come and also testify during the afternoon. And I hope you understand, if you haven't been through the process before, when I'm notified there in the room because of their schedule, I try to call them out of order to give them an opportunity to testify, even if you've signed up before them. But Senator Courtney has agreed to stay today as long as is necessary so everyone can and give their testimony. And if we absolutely run out of time, this has been a long week for us, we will have another public hearing, and those who have signed up that did not testify will be invited back to have that opportunity. As you come forward, if you have heard the testimony that you want to present given by another witness, feel free to say you agree with that witness and give your own personal sharing, but it's of great aid to the committee if you don't repeat what five other witnesses said. And that also gives more people an opportunity to speak. But we're delighted to have you here today, and it should be very good. So
waiting for the governor.
We are waiting for the governor, who should be here in just a couple minutes. So you're free to talk and relax.
I have to say that with the chair described gutting and stuffing, that is not immoral, illegal, or unethical move that we're going to make. That's done all the time. So I hope everybody understands that, those who heard that, that's what we're doing with the bill legislation. We're not doing anything wrong up here. So I get real nervous when we start saying those things, Mr. Chair. You know what I'm saying?
I understand.
And the tap public hearings, that doesn't mean we don't care about all those other bills. That's done to keep your bills alive. So the tap was not an attempt to suppress democracy. So please, those of you here for the first time, don't go out of here thinking, what is this crazy committee doing? They're suppressing the world. We're not suppressing anybody. You've got to explain those things, right, Neil?
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And in my earlier comments about our first three meetings and what we looked at, we also had help from the National Council of State Legislators, because all legislators are interested in these issues. We had the deputy director from the Oregon, the Organization of Juvenile Justice Directors in Washington, D.C., John Wilson, speak. So the on the federal level, that they're very much interested in this, too. We had Leslie Coco from the National Council of Crime and Delinquency in California, and she had a particular interest in female offenders. We have a tendency not to separate offenders based on gender, because we try not to separate anything much on gender anymore. But we've discovered that that is an important thing to consider. Do we have room service? This is for us. Good. That we were missing the boat on our criminal justice programs when we don't consider the difference between female and male, because there is a distinction, and that, I think, brought that to our attention, too. So it would be wonderful to have all those people back in some way. Senator Brown.
I don't have any. I'm checking any other questions, but they're sitting on the floor here. Can't we just bring them up here? Bring them up here?
Sure. Where is it? Yeah. Do we have someone on the floor?
Yeah, sitting on the floor.
We have two chairs over here. Senator Nelson will probably join us later. He's chairing his own committee right now. And then we have some chairs over in the corner over here if these young students would like to sit there.
Very special.
The governor is going to think we've expanded the committee. All right. You're under oath. Where do you attend school?
Highland Park.
Highland Park. And why are you in school today?
We're supposed to teach you work.
I see. And what grade are you in?
Eighth.
Eighth grade in Highland Park. And and you've chosen our committee today, and why is that? So one answer was you're the best. The other one said the teacher told us to come here. Well, welcome. You want to provide us with your name?
Casey.
Casey.
Michelle.
Shannon.
Casey.
Drew. And are you Republicans or Democrats?
Oh, it's all. And Neil. Don't be doing that. We were chewed after the session.
Oh,
Well, they've learned the first lesson in politics, and that is patience, because you always have to wait.
Great. Senate time.
We should have a pretty good time. It is the best.
Well, Jeff, why don't you come up to work for a second? I got some questions for you. This is Jeff Tryant. He runs our progress board. He just gave me the draft of the new benchmark blue book. So before the governor comes, why don't you quickly tell us about this?
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I guess I'm just speaking on the record here. This is informal, but 2 years ago, the Progress Board did the first version of a report that matched up the benchmarks with state agencies. State agencies are required in the budget process to show which benchmarks they link into, but we never had a way of knowing once they were in the budget for who was linked to what. So we created a report last time around where you could look up each of the benchmarks that Oregon has as the societal indicators, if you will, that we're looking towards and see which agencies were supposed to be working on them, which ones were signed up as having primary link and which ones signed up as having a secondary link. And so you could see how many agencies there were, and you could also look and see which agencies were signed up for which benchmark. So this time around, we've improved it at the chair's recommendation, I might add, to show where we have multiple agencies and they have a coordinated plan that they're actually working with one another towards achieving the benchmark, and also who the lead agency is. So you would be able to see for any of the benchmarks where there were, in most cases, where there were multiple agencies where the state had a significant role, which agency actually had lead responsibility for achieving the outcomes in the benchmark. That'll be out sometime next week. We have a couple of final changes. The other important note is that we are now co-doing this report with the Department of Administrative Services. So this will become more and more a part of the agency planning process. Hopefully this next time around, in the interim, when agencies are developing their work plans and developing their strategic plans, we'll be using the benchmark to show which agencies they're working on with on which issues and what the status of the plan is.
The coordination became important in the interim budget committee because we saw that we had all these programs and they shared the same benchmarks, but there didn't seem to be an integrated policy or a way they were tying it together. And the administration felt that was a shortcoming, and so by tying it to the benchmarks, having a lead agency, we think we'll do that. So appreciate you doing that.
My pleasure.
Good club size for lunch.
Well, we could ask the students themselves what they think, how they think we could resolve the school crisis.
All right. Senator Brown has a question for you. Senator Brown?
What do you folks think about how we can resolve the juvenile crime prevention problem and sort of prevent issues like Littleton and Thurston? Experts.
Just kids bringing guns and knives to school in your school?
Last year we had a kid bring a gun to school. The other day a kid got a knife.
Yeah.
Put a hole in the bus. Yeah.
Not a lot, but
no. It'll happen once in a while.
So you would suggest metal detectors for those you don't know about?
I hope. But it would be so expensive, and already our schools don't have that much money. I know that programs about, like, we already do, like, dares. Well, we don't do that anymore as our age. I think that we should have programs like that where kids can learn, like, the effects and consequences of their actions and what they're actually doing. So I think that lots of kids don't realize what we're doing or what they're doing really hurts people.
Sure, one more question.
Yeah, Senator Brown.
One of the concerns we have is that kids don't always know who to tell when somebody brings a knife or a gun. What do you do if somebody brings a knife or a gun? Do you know who to tell? The kids know?
We were talking about this the other day. They told us to tell how the counselor. They told us to tell one of them or the office or our teachers.
We need to have like some kind of, well, like mental health and stuff that people might see you or, you know, like if you get around each other, but they need to have some kind of like line or something that is confidential. You can call or something if you need to report.
And people can't hear about it.
Pardon?
And people can't hear about it.
A confidential way of reporting.
Yeah, if you just call somebody to find out, then they might do something with you.
Thank you.
The challenge with metal detectors is, of course, to have to either have one at each doorway or steer everyone through one doorway. And then you have to have someone guard the other doorways, else it's not effective. And you have to do it not just in the morning and at noon and in the afternoon. Basically, you have to do it on a full-time basis because of the mobility of students going in and out. So probably if the school wanted to go in that direction, they'd have to rely on a lot of volunteer help to help do that. I was in Texas a year ago, and they had a school that a district that went to uniforms, to get rid of the baggy clothing and the fact that you can hide drugs and things. And also on all purses and all backpacks, they had to be clear so that you could see what was in them. What do you think about that?
I don't think that we should have uniforms because I think that it could be just as easy to hide weapons and drugs and stuff in uniforms as it is in just regular clothing. I mean, right now, we're not. Right now, like, people don't. You don't express your individuality, which is important when you're a kid, because like a lot of times people don't know how to ask out how they feel, so they'll dress how they feel. If you quit, or like if you don't give them that opportunity to dress how they feel, they might start asking out more like violent ways and things. They can express, be like who they are and stuff, but if they're more of a violent kid, you might not want them expressing who they are through action.
It's a difficult issue, isn't it?
Yeah, talking about all these issues and stuff, but like, yeah.
I'm glad you are. Well, we're now going to be joined by Governor Kitzhaber, so it's always a pleasure to have you in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And as you can see, we've expanded our committee this afternoon. They're from Highland Park, they're 8th graders.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, John Kitzhaber, Governor of the State of Oregon. And Mr. Chairman, I, as I walked in, I wanted to just compliment the Senate President for this change in composition of this committee. I now feel confident that if the vote were taken today on Senate Bill 555, the amendments would have passed out handily, so I appreciate that. On a serious note, I do appreciate very much the opportunity to be here, and I appreciate your willingness to have a hearing on our amendments to Senate Bill 555, which essentially is the budgetary approach to the issue of at-risk group youth and juvenile crime prevention. And I think it's very important to note that this hearing was scheduled prior to the tragic events in Littleton and not as a reaction to it. I will say, however, that the sad events in Columbine High School are a powerful reminder, or should be, to all of us of the tragedy at Thurston High School almost 1 year ago. And it underscores, it seems to me, the necessity and the imperative that we act in a definitive fashion to try to intercede with at-risk children who are at risk of exploding into these acts of violence out of rage or alienation or frustration. And I, as the people of Colorado unite, just as the people of Thurston United, I find myself frustrated because what will I tell the governor of Colorado, newly elected, that although there is tremendous discourse about prevention at the time that these incidents occur, and certainly the press focuses on it. And then a year later, many of the brave statements about letting it in here seem to give way to other budgetary priorities. And I think that it does offer us an opportunity to reflect about the priorities that we want to make here in the state of Oregon. This investment package of $57 million has three components, as you know. One is the $30 million that will allow each of the 36 counties to develop a county-specific response to at-risk youth in their jurisdiction. A second is $20 million for drug and alcohol treatment. And as you know, some 70% of the crimes committed in the state are associated with substance abuse, and there are appalling new statistics about the increasing use of alcohol in middle schools in Oregon. And for us to be aware of this and not take action seems at best irresponsible. And $7 million for the very early childhood intervention. That in itself, I think, is an important response to the problem we're dealing with here. But I would like to add one other bit of perspective. Given this legislature's concern about the adequacy of K-12 funding and recognizing the honest differences about what that level should be, I would suggest to you that this package of investments has as much to do with education as anything we are likely to do. I was at 17 different school districts in the last 3 days around the state, and in each case, when the districts talked about the kinds of things that they would replace with additional funding, it included things like school counselors, who are an enormously important pressure valve for this kind of thing. The importance of childhood development specialists who can recognize these kinds of kids. The importance of alternative learning environments for that handful of disruptive kids who need additional time in the school. I believe that making investment in the package before you will significantly reduce the number of damaged kids who get into our educational system, who bring those problems with them, who drive up educational costs and have the highest risk of school dropout and school failure and later involvement in the criminal justice system. It is a close fit. And if we will make this investment, in addition to increasing our investment in the K-12 system, I think we will have made a huge and critical first step towards a rational and effective response to what everyone in this state recognizes as a horrendous social problem. Will these investments guarantee that these kinds of tragedies will never occur in the future? No. Will it ensure that we won't have some children who will eventually snap? No. But it will certainly put us on the right road in terms of reordering our priorities in a way that I believe is much needed. We have invested, as you know, Mr. Chairman, hundreds of millions of dollars to incarcerate people after they've committed a crime. And if indeed this society's values are reflected by its priorities, it's clear that we value punishment. And I think that we should also value our children enough to spend a tiny percentage of what we are spending on punishment and incarceration, keeping them from ever having to reach that point in the first place. I think this is our opportunity and our vehicle to have a discussion here in Oregon. I think we may disagree on how best to get there, and I appreciate that honest people can disagree about how you make these investments, but I do not believe we can leave this session without a significant investment in resources to try to prevent these things and ensure that these young people and their colleagues have the very best opportunity possible to succeed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for the governor? Thank you for taking the time to start off our hearing. I'd next invite Pam Curtis and Bobby Green.
Good afternoon, Chair Bryant, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Pam Curtis. I'm a policy analyst in the Governor's Office of Healthcare, Human Services, and Labor. My job today is to try to set a little bit of a historical context for you and to put into some kind of framework what you're about to hear about. And I'm going to refer to the -3 amendments for Senate Bill 555. I understand there are others, but I'll be referring to the -3 amendments. In January of 1996, the governor asked then-Attorney General Ted Kulongowski to chair a task force on reducing juvenile crime through prevention and early intervention. This was the second task force, actually, in a three-year period of time to address Oregon's growing juvenile crime problem. The task force report was issued in September of 1996, and it literally represented the work of hundreds of Oregonians. In the introduction to that report from Attorney General Kulongowski, he described the strategies in the recommendations and the strategies in the report as the beginning, and the beginning of acknowledging children as Oregon's most valuable resource. Some of the task force report recommendations have been implemented, including strategies we've put in place to reduce the number of minority youth in the juvenile justice system and adjustments to Senate Bill 1. The Dash 3 amendments before you today represent the next step in implementation of the task force report. It emphasizes the following directions from the task force: the early identification and intervention of at-risk and high-risk youth, coordination of resources, engaging communities and citizens in the solutions, evaluating the effectiveness and using proven practices in the strategies that we put into place, instigating performance-based accountability, implementing a multi-stage, multi-age approach in our strategies, and establishing a means to coordinate and connect state resources, local resources, and state and local resources. I think you'll hear today that the Dash 3 amendments do those things. You'll hear that the Dash 3 amendments represent a multi-stage, multi-age approach to a continuum of state and local services for early childhood services, high-risk youth, and connecting them local alcohol and drug treatment for families who have young children and for adolescents. These services would occur inside of state policy with direction and guidance, but with local flexibility for planning, for strategies, and for implementation. A consistent evaluation framework would be applied to each individual effort and to the overall effort. And each effort, in turn, would be woven together into a comprehensive plan to address the needs of each community's family, youth, and children. I want to illustrate how this would work, and I think you have a graphic with you, and there's a graphic that's been put up here on the poster board. I have kind of a scratchy voice, so I'm going to try to walk over here, and if you can't hear me, let me know, and I'll come back.
As the chart illustrates, there are pieces, and the three pieces that we've talked about today in the Dash 3 amendments are the early childhood, the alcohol and drug, and the high-risk juvenile crime partnership. This represents the work that is going on, that has gone on, and will go on at the local level to come around and coordinate juvenile crime prevention strategies for high-risk youth, early childhood programs, alcohol and drug services. Each of those, as you can see, is connected to some kind of statewide body, generally that represents both state and local interests, except that policy framework that I mentioned just a few moments ago. These would stay connected in terms of the policy framework and the approval mechanism for those local plans. In addition to that, at a local level, these pieces would be woven together and linked.
Pam, if you could stand on the other side, the mic will pick up your voice for the record.
No problem. Okay. So these individual pieces will be woven together into a coordinated, comprehensive plan, because not only do they need to be linked within a common framework, at a community level they need to be linked together so that the community is taking a comprehensive look at what's needed for their children and families 0 to 18 and at all levels of risk. So the role of coordinating and convening and directing the development of that comprehensive plan, you'll see in the Dash 3 amendments, is spelled out as a role for the state and local commissions on children and families. Bring together the interest groups and the stakeholders necessary to put together that overall plan. So I think you'll have to copy that in the material you were given.
Each part of this coordinated plan that's been identified to date and that you see illustrated on the chart here has gone through at least 1 year, and in some cases, such as the High-Risk Juvenile Crime Prevention Partnership, several years of negotiation and system building among a broad group of stakeholders to design what you ultimately see in front of you in the Dash 3 amendments. I want to illustrate also that you see some dotted lines there. Those represent work yet to be done. We're committed, and I think the governor has continued to be committed to doing the necessary system improvement work and then adding those as components to this coordinated plan. In the interim, we're going to take on the issue of mental health services next, and there's one that's blank to represent the whole series of things that will need to continue to be added and happen. The work in putting together these frameworks around the juvenile crime prevention strategy, around the early childhood system, around alcohol and drug, as I mentioned, represent literally hundreds of stakeholders coming together. I provided you with letters of support in your packet from some of these stakeholder groups, and I'll continue to add to them next week. During the testimony today, you will hear about a defined role for the state and local commissions on children and families in coordinating and facilitating the development of the comprehensive plan for children 0 to 18, as it's illustrated on the chart. The Dash 3 amendments, I want to emphasize, don't change anything else about the roles of the Commission on Children and Families at the state or local level, except to grant them authority to convene and coordinate the entities necessary to develop this plan. And that's described in sections 1 through 10 of the Dash 3 amendments. You'll also hear from testimony today about an initiative to reduce and prevent juvenile crime by focusing on high-risk youth as one part, as you see illustrated, of the comprehensive strategy. And that's outlined in sections 21 through 27 of the Dash 3 amendments. You'll hear about the development of an early childhood system of supports that includes expanding and coordinating existing services such as Healthy Start as another part of the coordinated plan, and that's outlined in section 12 of the Dash 3s. You'll hear about improvements in the appropriateness and the efficacy of alcohol and other drug treatment. That's found in sections 16 through 20. Then you'll hear about a consistent evaluation framework that's based on the Oregon benchmarks, and that's found in section 11. Overall, the Dash 3s, I think, represent a systemic, multi-stage approach to supporting our kids and our families. It doesn't transfer or move programs or power or control. It's not a sweeping reform of anything, and it doesn't do any damage to existing programs or agencies. Nor does it detail which programs should be funded or which approaches should be taken by local decision makers. Instead, the Dash 3 set up a consistent policy framework and an integrated service system. In doing so, it integrates efforts and resources. It combines the best of proven practices with the wisdom of local communities. It's flexible enough to ensure that any individual program can be, and actually should be, coordinated with the other programs in its community serving children and families. And it provides a concrete method to ensure that both state and local programs are accountable for the resources they spend and for the outcomes that they achieve. To give you a perspective on local outcomes and participation, Commissioner Bobby Green is with me today. Commissioner Green chairs the Lane County Board of Commissioners, and today he represents the Association of Oregon Counties. He chairs our Human Services and Public Safety Subcommittee and has been actively involved in many of the discussions leading to the development of what you have in front of you. I want to take just an opportunity to thank the AOC and Commissioner Green for their hard work and partnership. The AOC has been our primary partner in developing the policies before you today. They were actively involved in crafting the High-Risk Juvenile Crime Prevention Partnership. They co-chair the early childhood system development that you see as well, and they oversee the planning for local alcohol and other drug treatment services. The governor gives great deference to their perspective, and I'm pleased to share testimony with Commissioner Green.
Thank you, Pam, for that introduction. Excuse me, Senator O'Brien, thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to participate in this hearing on Senate Bill 555-3. Also, I want to welcome your distinguished guests as well. It's always a treat to see young people involved in local decision making, but it's even more of a treat to see them here at the state level lending their wisdom to this process here. I appreciate that. For some reason, this entire episode, before I start, I do have copies of my testimony along with several attachments. There's an editorial from the Eugene Register Guard in Eugene, as well as a statement from the local Lane County Commission on Children and Family describing what the gateway of system change would or should look like. But as I mentioned earlier, it just seems as though for some reason this whole entire episode of this legislation seems like deja vu. As a former high school football coach, it seems like I've been in a contest that has been in overtime for the last 2 years. And it also seems like every time we get into the red zone, the defense seems to stiffen up and another scoring threat goes awry.
But nevertheless, I will remain focused and present to you my testimony in hopes that it will be a benefit and not a hindrance to your process. I just want you to know that AOC is fully supportive of the JCPAC language and agreement since they went through our full review and approval process and were endorsed as one of AOC's six priorities for this 1999 legislative session. In addition, both myself and Commissioner Dean Furman worked extensively on the proposal. Commissioner Furman now chairs the JCPAC. We respect the good work of all the good people involved in developing what everyone hopes is good legislation. We believe the process utilized to bring this legislation to this point was done with the best intention. However, given that these additions, these other components, they have not actually gone through our process, which would include the committee that I chair. So consequently, today we're not ready to endorse the full concept. However, we generally support the inclusion of the prevention and intervention services in juvenile crime prevention and continuum and are actively involved in work on them, as Pam Curtis pointed out. Commissioner Sue Cameron co-chairs the Home Visitors Task Force, and other commissioners and county staff are involved in that process. Commissioner Gina Furman is also involved in working on the proposed alcohol and drug component. AOC will begin to review these other proposed components of Senate Bill 555, specifically early childhood and alcohol and drugs. Once this process is completed, we will share the results of our review with the legislature. AOC has learned, as well learned, that we must carefully and thoroughly process major positions in our association so as not to create or split organization where we are unable to reach consensus. Now, we do understand that you must proceed with your process, and we respect that. We only ask that you respect our process as well. As mentioned earlier, I chair the AOC Human Services and Public Safety Committee, and we will begin to review all of these proposals. And my commitment to you today is that they will receive our immediate and thoughtful consideration. I guess my only final comment, and one to be brief in my address to you, is that we do commend you for putting this proposal together, for which addresses some critical issues which our county faces. I want to urge you to go forward. And whatever happens, don't let the epitaph of Senate Bill 555 read, "Never have so many worked so hard for so long to achieve so little." Thank you very much.
Questions?
I just want to say that the chair and I were quietly discussing which position you played in football before you testified. Mm-hmm. Then I had to describe to Senator Brown what the red zone meant in football. I mean, don't take that wrong, Commissioner, but I've been up here educating people, and we were both vetting the position now, and so I just want you to know that, because I think I had to do that. Thanks for helping me out with that. Yeah. You do phrase red zone, I had to help her out.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Actually, at the U of O, I played on defense. I was an outside linebacker. So.
I missed it. You're right.
But you described the red zone accurately, though.
In 20 yard line.
Thank you for that testimony. We'll now go to Donald Middleton and Gary Weeks.
Thank you for having us.
Oh.
Thank you.
Oh, yes. Thank you for coming.
I don't want to listen to it.
I'm happy to.
Well.
You're going to miss the best part.
I'm going to say that that they said you were good-looking as the governor. They left the room, Gary.
Who is?
Gary is.
Oh. Gary. He meant you.
Donna, are you going to go first?
I think I will.
Please.
Mr. Chair, my name for the record is Donna Middleton. I'm the Director of the Commission on Children and Families, and I'm here to talk specifically about the section regarding Children and Families Comprehensive Plan. And to let you know that the plan was developed in 555 to strengthen the planning process for local commissions on children and families, as well as the state commission's role in comprehensive planning. The plan was not intended to rewrite commission legislation. It was not intended to preclude community building. It was not intended to preclude volunteer participation and community mobilization. It was intended to strengthen the role of local commissions and the state commission around bringing a comprehensive planning process into each local community. Currently, we have a number of planning processes going on in local communities. We have alcohol and drugs. We have mental health. We have public health. We have local juvenile justice planning processes. One of the things that I think is necessary to get a comprehensive view of what's happening in local communities is to bring all of those planning processes together and review what they can tell us at a local level. And then for the State Commission, along with state partners such as Department of Human Resources and others, to use those planning processes to develop plan processes for policy and for funding packages. Right now, when we plan in isolation of one another, it is very difficult to know what a comprehensive look at a community system would be. And so I believe that this particular portion of 555 strengthens that role and makes it clear that the role of the local commissions is to bring those folks to the table, review all planning processes, and develop a comprehensive community plan. And so I just wanted to make sure that people understood that the attempt for the planning was not an attempt to rewrite 2004 in its entirety.
Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Gary Weeks. I'm the director of the Department of Human Resources and also appear today, I guess, as a member of the State Commission on Children and Families. There are two statutory members of this commission, as some of you may know. One is the director of the Department of Human Resources. The other is the superintendent of schools. So those are kind of two roles that I play. Over the lifetime of the commission, I think it's fair to say and accurate to say we've really struggled with the role of the state commission vis-a-vis the role of the local commissions. And Commissioner Green equated this to the football game. I think of it as more as in terms of Bill Murray's movie Groundhog's Day, which is every day sort of starts over and it runs the same course with the same sorts of debates, maybe a little bit of change, but the outcome is never as good as one would hope. And we've really struggled with that as a member of the commission for me for the last 4 years. We've struggled to try to figure out what's meant in the existing statutes by phrases such as the commission will set the priorities for serving children and families. Who's responsible for doing that? How do we ensure that's an inclusive process? How do we assure that we have a statewide planning system? What's the role of the local agent of the state agencies in local planning, and how should the planning of state agencies relate to the statewide comprehensive plan? How do we establish and then measure outcomes against recognized benchmarks? Those are just a few of the questions that we have continually wrestled with for years. This legislation that you're now considering, Senate Bill 555, with the -3 amendments, I think goes a long way to clarifying many of the questions that we've struggled with over recent years. The proposed legislation says very clearly that the State Commission is to set policies and guidelines for the planning, the coordination, and the delivery of services by local commissions. And it says very clearly that that's to be done with other planning bodies and with state agencies. So in other words, the way I read it is that it's at the table of local commissions where these conversations about the statewide comprehensive coordinated plan are going to be developed. And there are going to be lots of seats around that table, that local table. Among the seats will be those occupied by state agencies and others by nonprofit organizations and providers and volunteers and all sorts of people. But it's that local table where that statewide comprehensive and coordinated plan is going to be first developed. And agencies like DHR have a responsibility not to approve or bless a local plan, but to be one of the participants that's engaged in the development of that local plan and to be assured that the services that we're responsible for as a state agency are part of that coordinated plan. And that doesn't mean just the services for the children that are in families that are at highest risk, because I'm afraid that's that's one of the things that's read into, or could be read into this bill as it's drafted with the amendments, that it's aimed at only the highest risk kids. And that is not the way I read it. We have to develop a local plan and then subsequently a state plan that addresses not only the families and kids at highest risk, but those that are of lesser risk in local communities. I think the other important thing about the bill and the amendments is that it forces state agencies to begin to try to align their own plans, long-term plans, with local plans. And Donna and others know that I've advocated this for the last couple of years at the local commission. We have never had anything that requires state agencies to lay their own planning for the future against the planning that's developed at the local area and then bubbles up the statewide comprehensive plans through the state commission. You know, you have two processes. You have a local planning process which develops a statewide comprehensive plan, and then as state agencies, we go about developing our own plans and bring those to you. And I think this bill sets us in motion to say those things should be overlaying. You should be able to see how state agency plans support what is adopted as local plans and eventually as statewide plans. So for that reason and for those reasons, I guess I should say I'm here as both a member of the commission, but also, and maybe more importantly, as the director of the department, to tell you that I think there's some very, very good things in this bill that will get us out of our Groundhog's Day syndrome. And I'll be pleased to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Questions, Mr. Lee? Thank you for your testimony.
Yes, I did have a question, Mr. Middleton. Did you have written testimony?
Yes, I do.
Did you provide written?
I have it. I'll make copies. I have it.
Yes, Senator Cardi has
a ways and means question. How much money are we talking about when we say planning?
How much money are we talking about when we say planning? Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Courtney, usually a commission on children and family can take a percentage of their grant stream dollars to do planning for the local communities that they serve. There is not a set dollar amount currently for planning. As a matter of fact, local commissions would tell you that they are currently maxed out on their planning resources because they only require in House Bill 2004 a staff of two people to do local commission work. And so that is all currently the resource that they have to do planning.
Sure.
I'm sorry. I'm just looking at the legislation, and there was a little something you said in your testimony that concerns me a little bit. How different is the legislation on page 3, lines 27 through 29, from what is in 2004? I mean, are we seeing a veering away from 2004 through this legislation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Chitub, what we're looking at is a part of the legislation that talks about guidelines for planning, coordination, and delivery of services rather than setting policy. So in that respect, the language is different in 2004 for this particular section.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I now invite Rick Hill, Steve Carmichael, and Larry Old.
Mr. Chair, I believe Mr. Carmichael will lead off.
I'm Steve Carmichael. I'm the director of the Juvenile Department in Lane County and the president of the Juvenile Department Directors for the state, organization. The 36 county juvenile departments have been working on the juvenile justice part of this for about a year and a half, before the Thurston shooting even. And we support it. It represents the points of agreement that were made with the Association of Counties over that time. It's based on a strategy that you heard about when you went through all of the hours and days of testimony around the research, and just like to briefly recount that strategy. It is focused on the high-risk offender. We know that, actually we've done research now, and the majority of counties looking at juvenile offenders and finding out which kids return, which kids don't return. And we know that about 70 to 80% of the juveniles who commit a crime don't do it again. And so we really need to focus on that group that does recommit crimes. That group, about 20% of the population of offenders, commits about 80% of the crime. So it's a small portion of the juveniles who commit crimes that commit almost all, not almost all, but 80%, a large percentage of the crime. So this focuses on that high-risk population, the kids who come in the first time, that we can now identify by the use of risk factors that are spelled out in the bill, that will tell us if kids have two or more of those risk factors, they have a very high chance to reoffend, and that's the group we need to focus on. So the research that you heard in those days, as you recall, I'm sure, a lot of it focused on exactly that, that we now have the methodology and the research findings that will help us predict which juveniles are going to be the offenders, and we also have the research and best practice research of what works and what doesn't work. So this bill really focuses on that high-risk population and then focuses on doing the right thing with those kids, finding the kids who are at high risk and then using best practices to intervene in a way that will work. It also provides some basic services to the counties. As counties, every county develops their own plan. Every plan is different. I've looked at all of them. And they all have to address some basic services. Do they have an ability to detain a juvenile who's dangerous? If you pass a bill that says a juvenile who takes a gun to school has to be detained, do they have a way to do that? So there's some basic services of detention and supervision that are required. And then there are other services that can be developed according to best practice. And every county was given the opportunity to look at the research. That research was provided to them and select strategies that work, that have been proven to work. And finally, once we do that, we find the right kids, do the right things, the next step is to measure the outcome. And built into this process is a measurement process to evaluate with a statewide measurement as well as locally. Have those interventions paid off? Have we reduced the crime rate? Are kids more successful in school? Are they more successful with their parents? So it's a outcome-based, research-based program and an outcome-based program to find out, does it work? And you should know that fairly soon. I think in the next legislative session, you should have a result from this project. It's not a long-term project to find the right juveniles, make the right interventions, and see if the crime reduces. This should happen within a fairly short period of time. I think the strategy will reduce your juvenile crime in Oregon. It's critical that we do so. Our county is the one that went through the Thurston experience and are now reliving the emotion of that in the last few days. The people that spoke before, the governor and Bobby Green, Gary Weeks, others are absolutely right, and the chair when he spoke that we have to now do something. We have to stop talking about it, planning for it, and actually take action, and this bill will make a difference.
Thank you, Chair Bryant, members of the committee. My name is Larry Oglesby, Director of the Marion County Juvenile Department, and I'm here to talk a little bit about the Juvenile Crime Prevention Partnership, and I want to emphasize the word partnership. This is an effort that began really right after the last session adjourned of the legislature, when a group of our juvenile directors met with the governor and began a process which has really been ongoing all during that time, culminating really in June of last year with the Association of Oregon Counties adopting the Points of Agreement document that I believe you've seen, which is now incorporated in the bill. So this is a state-local partnership. It's also has a success already, and it's already been produced 36 individual county plans that have been completed, been reviewed by the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee and the governor, and are ready to implement subject to legislative action. This is a locally driven process. Hundreds of local volunteers in each county were involved in planning for this, developing these plans, identifying the most critical issues in each of those counties, specific to those counties. And the result, I believe, is a series of plans that provide programs and services that address the unique needs of each of those communities, focusing, as Steve said, on the risk factors that have been determined to be most predictive of delinquent behavior. The plans are broken out into basic services, and to give you an example of this unique nature, many counties, perhaps most, have a dire need for detention space, and so basic services in those plans focused on detention or alternatives to detention to address that need. Other counties who may have adequate detention were able to focus on other portions of the graduated sanctions in a juvenile system. The other segment is the high-risk dollars, and those were focused on research-based programs that focus both on intervention and prevention of further criminality of the youth who are involved. The risk, target group of youth are youth who are just entering or about to enter the juvenile system, and it's our hope and our belief that focusing on these youth, and in many cases focus on the entire family, many of the plans that you will see have a focus not just on the kid who's been referred, but on siblings, on parents to deal with the family issues so that we can stop the criminal behavior before they enter further into the system. And finally, I think what we will hope to see from this, and we will see from this, is a couple of things. One, restoring credibility to the juvenile system by enhancing our ability to provide certain and swift consequences. I've said before committees here in the legislature before, we've had a decade really of disinvestment in the juvenile system where we've done nothing to, done very little actually to increase our capacity to address issues like gangs, the increasing numbers of youth, and the more serious crimes, and this is a step in the right direction. And then secondly, as we're able to bring some of those issues under control to begin to intervene earlier, if we had our druthers, we would be working with younger kids, not high school kids, but middle school kids and even elementary kids before they get in the system rather than those who are already in the system. And we think this this plan and the strategy will go a long way and help us to do that.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Rick Hill. I'm the director of the Oregon Youth Authority. The Oregon Youth Authority fully supports Senate Bill 555 with the -3 amendments, with particular interest and investment in the sections relating to the Juvenile Crime Prevention Partnership, Sections 21 through 27. As Steve and Larry have indicated, the planning process at the local level was broad-based and very inclusive. In many counties, if not all counties, the Oregon Youth Authority staff at the local level were also involved in that planning process through our membership with the local Public Safety Coordinating Council. The plans that were submitted to the JCPAC clearly reflect each county's unique juvenile crime prevention needs. While staying within the parameters of the planning process, best practices, and the overall outcomes desired. There were, however, two areas of needed improvement as determined by the JCPAC during the plan review process. One of those areas was the connection with schools. Governor Kitzhaber pointed that out earlier in his testimony. The other was addressing the issues of cultural competency and gender-specific services. So at the request of the JCPAC, several state agencies, with help from some of the counties, are ready to provide training and technical assistance in the area of cultural competency to counties and other participants of the planning process. As you know, the issue of disproportionate minority confinement is a significant issue within juvenile and adult corrections both. We believe that if we ignore the minority communities in our planning process, juvenile crime prevention plans will fall well short of their potential impact on the arrest rates and on the future incarceration costs in Oregon. I think following witnesses will elaborate on that issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve, I had one question, and this goes back to last January, but I want to make sure I have my facts straight. After the Thurston shooting, you put to the voters in Lane County a very comprehensive at-risk and juvenile offender program, and it was defeated. And was that in the November election?
It was in the November election.
And as I recall, it was defeated by people under 50% turned out, but there was an undervoter. And if you could just give me your synopsis of that, and you were still in amazement at the time we last talked about why it happened, and I was wondering if you had any further analysis of it.
We've conducted surveys to try to find out, and we're planning for the next one, so we're still analyzing it. But I maybe have a little more information about it. It was a very comprehensive package that I think would have been a national model and one that would have made a tremendous difference in Lane County. Failed by less than 1%. It just slipped away from us. It was passing until the last day. It's one of those that you think is going to make it, but as the absentee ballots came in, it slid under. It actually represented the broad range, the continuum, all the way from some funds for the Healthy Start to beef up the Healthy Start program, all the way to running a forest work camp for adult inmates and juvenile services in an array inside that. We are building facilities that are really wonderful. We're building detention facilities, court facilities, a drug and alcohol treatment facility, a shelter, and an assessment center, all under construction now that will be done at the end of the year. And
the money to operate those was in that levy, so it was very difficult to see that go down. I think part of the problem was that it was such a broad range of services. There were 11 different components in the measure, and it was hard to explain that to people. And there were, when you have that many, there are many things. People might object to one thing and vote against it because of that. So that was a problem. Probably the biggest was that it was so complex, it was hard to get the message out in a way that really conveyed to people what it was about. As I said, we passed, and the people who voted the day of the election, it passed, and then as the absentees came in, and the polling really indicated 2 weeks afterward, we had a large majority of the people supporting it. So I think our campaign of information to explain it got out too late in these mail elections. As you all know, running for office, you have to have your campaign before the ballot go out, and we didn't do it early enough. And so the information was out. People were convinced after late in the election. I think that was our biggest failing.
What was amazing, as I recall, that it even failed in Springfield, of course, where it was first located.
It did fail in Springfield. That was a stunner to us. it's absolutely hard to understand that one. And we haven't done polling specifically in Springfield to try to sort that out. It failed in the outlying areas. The further you got out of Eugene, the more negative votes. But that's usually the case. It was even more so in this case. And I think partly that's because the facilities that were going to be supported are all in Eugene. So it's harder for people in Florence and Oak Ridge and Cottage Grove to support it. But the turndown in Springfield really was a stunner. Your memory's very good about that.
Well, we all get frustrated. And
yeah.
You put together a program, and the people you talk to are so enthusiastic about it. And of course, there you have that strong emotional reason, too. And,
right.
And it has to be such a letdown when it's not successful. And right. Then you think of the policymaker at the state level, okay, you know, this has to be, to a large extent, a community responsibility. And in the community where the greatest tragedy is in place, they're not stepping up.
Yep, that's right. I think we'll do it the next time. I think people are ready to support it. A lot of people said, you know, we voted for the facilities and we would vote to support them, but it was very broad range. First time we'd ever done that. We have passed many law enforcement levies, but they've been law enforcement officers, forest work camp, things that are much more concrete that people can see. And when we got into the prevention area and into these other services, it was harder to explain in a big package. And very close.
Yeah.
And we'll get there next time. We're going to be in the red zone again. We're
thank
crossing
you.
The goal.
Thank you.
Are you all, we have a question.
The 36 counties have done the planning and have programs for high-risk juveniles, correct?
Correct.
And Rick, you come along and say yes, but there's a school connection problem, there's a gender problem, there's a minority problem. Is that correct? In these 36 counties?
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, some of the counties did very well on that part of the planning process. Some of the larger counties that are familiar with those issues, some of the smaller counties in rural areas did not, in our opinion, in the opinion of the JCPAC, the 21 members that reviewed these things, feel that those issues were adequately addressed in the planning process. The governor approved the plans, all of them, and asked that all the counties participate in some technical assistance training workshops that the state, with the help of some counties, is putting on, and you'll hear about that in a minute.
And the age group that you're talking about is what, please?
They're juveniles that have either entered the juvenile justice system, first crime, and we're going to do something with them, or they're at imminent danger of entering the system within a couple of years. They're high-risk young adolescents.
Just give me the age, because age is going to be a very sensitive thing when you look at the agenda, who's going to testify as well. Just the earliest age you deal with.
Well, we had a 10-year-old in detention yesterday. We can start at 10. This was a kid shooting at other kids in the playground with a BB gun. So
there's not an age cut off.
There's not an age. We really stayed away from that. We had a lot of struggle trying to define it exactly by age, and we decided, no, it's someone who commits a crime or within 2 years could be in the system.
So it's not juvenile. The word juvenile should not be in here.
Oh, it should be in there. It's either they have committed a crime or...
All right, so when we say juvenile, we're saying 0 to 17, that's what we mean?
No. Within 2 years of entering the juvenile justice system, so within 2 years of being able to commit a crime. And that varies a little bit by criminal intent, so you can't say, I mean, this 10-year-old entered our system yesterday. We don't get very many 10-year-olds. but it's possible that we would get a 10-year-old. So I know some communities, one, for example, I don't want to talk too much, but one is looking at juvenile, potential juvenile sex offenders, kids who have expressed a lot of behavior that you would say is going to be a juvenile sex offender, and they're 8 years old. So it could go down that low, but most of the kids will be 10 to 12 or older that get into this system.
The purposes of our relating clause is 0 through 17.
Ah. I just want to make sure that you have the entire age group. That's what I was concerned about.
I'm sorry. The bill does. I think all of our remarks are focused on the juvenile justice sections, which in dash 3 are section 21 on. The earlier sections relate to the younger part.
Well, we got early childhood coming up here. I just, in terms of these plans and everything, I'm still wondering if we've covered all the age groups, and that's the only thing I'm trying to figure out here, because this is an issue for me and for others. I'm just curious about that.
These plans that we've referred to from the 36 counties are focused on section 21 on in the bill. They're the plans to deal with the juvenile offenders or near to be offenders.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Lonnie Jackson, Marco, and
Benavides,
thank you, and Tony Fernandez. Good afternoon, and welcome to Senate Judiciary.
Good afternoon. My name is Marco Benavides. I'm with the Office of Minority Services, Oregon Youth Authority. With me is Lonnie Jackson, the Director of the Minority Services. I would like to comment on yesterday's day, which to me is one of the most important days in the history of Oregon, as well as in the history of the United States. Yesterday we have the day of acknowledgement. Thank you for the people who attended. I recognize many faces. And we talk about past discrimination, and we talk about the history of Oregon. But also we talk about a day for commitment, and a day to move forward, and a day to do something in the future. I think today is the day we are taking concrete steps for the juvenile crime prevention, effort to be inclusive. And when I say inclusive, include the community of color, in increasing day by day, and also to meet the need of community of colors. I think the crime prevention plan is taking very concrete steps, and one of the most exciting ones is the training that we are putting together, and Lonnie Jackson is going to provide you more information about the training that we are putting together for all the counties in the state of Oregon.
Okay. Excuse me, I'm Chair Bryant, committee members. Once again, my name is Lonnie Jackson, Director of Office of Minority Services, and I, again, appreciate the opportunity to address you. And I'm really excited about the training that our Cultural Competency Gender-Specific Committee has worked real hard to put together. It's been an inter-agency committee that's really been committed to assisting the counties in terms of providing them assistance with addressing issues relative to minorities, particularly juveniles in our state. I think you have a brochure in front of you. This is we're looking at providing training at 7 different sites around the state between April and August of this year. Again, the training is really going to be broken up into about 5 components. The first component is looking at it in terms of culture as a conceptual tool for juvenile crime prevention. This is not a regular diversity one-on-one type of training. It's really focusing in on the value of incorporating culture and recognizing culture and meeting the needs of all of our youth in a culturally specific way as an asset in terms of preventing juvenile crime prevention. We're also going to be focusing in on the gender-specific issues. We have Pam Pad, Valdeen Hollingshead, who will provide that particular piece of the training. And again, it's to talk about the specific needs of young females that are susceptible to being involved in our system. After that, we're going to do some specific training around race, ethnic, specific pieces. I'm going to be training on Native American, Asian, African American, and Hispanic. And again, we're going to focus on the needs of why youth of color coming into the system, and also the type of services and programs that can help benefit them while they're in our services or out in the community. The last piece is really a critical piece. That's going to really spend a lot of time after we go through the day one and part of day two training to really focus in on how do you incorporate culture, gender-specific issues into a juvenile crime prevention plan. We're going to really provide a lot of technical assistance around that. Mr. Benavides, along with two other colleagues, will really discuss how to actually step-by-step look at the elements that need to be involved in culture and gender and crime prevention plan, and we're going to break up the counties into work groups to really do some hands-on work and really provide a lot of technical assistance. As Mr. Benavides also mentioned, I was at the Day of Acknowledgement yesterday, and I really got touched, you know, to kind of see the diversity at the legislature yesterday in the Capitol. In fact, somebody remarked, this is the future for Oregon in terms of the diversity that was represented. And even though it was definitely a day of acknowledgement in terms of the racial injustices that have existed or have, in Oregon in this past, it was also a step towards the future in terms of opening up the dialogue about culture, improving race relations, and what we all need to do to respect and value diversity. And I really believe this training is going to serve a lot of that purpose, as well as helping to prevent young people of color and all young people from getting involved in our juvenile justice system. I really believe it's going to enhance us as a people in a dialogue about really valuing, respecting, and really seeing diversity as something, you know, to be treasured. So I'm really excited about the training. People have worked hard to put it on, and we feel it'd be an asset to the juvenile crime prevention plan.
We also, as a follow-up of the training, and we believe training is now the solution, is part of the solution. In coordination, Oregon Youth Authority with the Commission on Children and Families, we are in the process of hiring a full-time person that is going to provide technical assistance and support to all the counties and also the crime prevention. So that's a follow-up, and as well as in coordination with the Office of Minority Services, we will provide the services and technical assistance necessary for them to incorporate cultural competency into their plans. Finally, the most important one for us is to address the issue of disproportionate of minority confinement in the justice system. And that through that process, we are going to address early prevention intervention in dealing with minority overrepresentation. For many instances, people think, well, minority overrepresentation needs to be dealt at the end of the continuum. We believe that minority overrepresentation begins early in the community, when the students drop out, teen pregnancy, and all of that is affecting our minority communities, and that needs to be put in place early.
Marco, if you could lean back just a couple of inches from
sure.
The microphone.
Sure. I think I'm done with the presentation.
Good afternoon, Chairman Bryant and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, I am Antonio Fernandez, Minister for K-12 School Improvement and Support for the Beaverton School District. I am in support of the Senate Bill 55, this three amendments. As a central office administrator, I have witnessed the efforts of our central office administrators, as well as our building principals, attempting to work with other social agencies on behalf of early childhood issues, as well as issues surrounding the reduction of juvenile crimes. This has been a very difficult endeavor. Beaverton School District is a new player working with outside agencies. It's become a must for us to become a vital player due to our fast-changing demographics, which now include 20% minority students. We're concerned with the coordination of our psychologists, our counseling program, our child development specialists with mental health departments. We're concerned with further counseling services to violent students that we're identifying not only for the students but for the families. Even though our clients, children, and families are the same, our missions, budgets, and organizations makeup have kept us apart, at least at this point for us. I believe that Senate Bill 553, with its local commission on children and families, is the vehicle that can provide the necessary coordination among a multitude of agencies, including education, and thereby create an effective system without duplication, which will more effectively serve our students and our families. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions from the panel? Thank you. Next on early childhood system development, Donald Middleton, Linda Fleming, and Donna Schnickner. Please begin.
Okay. Mr. Chair, once again, for the record, I'm Donna Middleton. I'm the Director of the Commission on Children and Families. And the other section of Senate Bill 555 deals with the home visiting early childhood system. For approximately 7 months now, there have been a number of agencies, local and state, working on a comprehensive view of an early childhood system. And to address Senator Courtney's question, this piece of the system is looking at 0 to 8 for connectivity to the other planning processes. The governor in August of this year asked that agencies that had put in requests to expand their early childhood systems, meaning the public health system, the Commission on Children and Families, and the Department of Ed with its Head Start system, come together to try to look at what a comprehensive system would look like, including home visitation, but also the broad-based 0 to 8 system for children and families. And there was, at that time, a perception that there was a lot of folks doing the same thing in the local areas around home visiting, around other kinds of early childhood processes for families. So we set out to develop committees and look at a system of early childhood intervention and particularly prevention around a home visiting system, one of which would be the Healthy Start system that the Commission on Children and Families currently operates. So part of this piece of the bill, -3 amendments on page 20, section 12, discusses an early childhood system and the process that we're going through in looking at how we can coordinate and collaborate and look at that part of our system. And I will let the other ladies continue to talk about their portion of that process.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Linda Fleming. I'm the Executive Director of the Coalition of Local Health Officials. We represent the 34 local health departments around the state. Our many, many years of experience in maternal child health programs have shown us that the situations confronting families with infants and small children are varied and diverse in their level of need and complexity. And we strongly feel that a response and support system equally as varied and diverse in professional capacity and services is required for effective and efficient intervention. Cole first started looking at the issue, specifically at that time, home visiting several months ago, way over a year ago, with the intention of trying to integrate and collaborate with other programs, specifically at that time, the Healthy Start program. From that point, we moved into becoming an active and cooperating partner in the planning process that Donna refers to. Toward this goal of a more efficient and effective system, and for purposes of CLO's representatives to best represent CLO and what we believe in and what we have found over 96 years of providing services in this state, we had some principles, not policies, but some principles that we entered into these discussions for an early childhood support system. Those principles included, one, that services should be in a seamless delivery system determined at the local level, with assurance of collaboration and inclusion of specific disciplines and agencies. And two, a system design must reflect a multidisciplinary continuum of comprehensive services that demonstrate certain efficiencies. Included among those efficiencies would be use of a single assessment tool as adopted statewide. Risk assessment completed by a professional discipline with demonstrated assessment skills. That determination of intervention, type of intervention, an appropriate provider would be based upon risk and research-based models with proven effectiveness. We also strongly believe that paraprofessionals should be used at different levels of risk with supervision and support of a professional skilled at recognizing changing family dynamics, offering co-worker support and so that co-worker limitations and stress could be easily and quickly identified. And last but not least, we believe that any system should incorporate and embody measurable outcomes and evaluation criteria. The early childhood system support system that is in Senate Bill 555 embraces those principles and strengthens all services to families. We believe that to be true because it does not eliminate any existing service, but it's rather that it strengthens all of them by coordinating and providing supportive resources available to the staff. It allows for innovative approaches that best meet individual community needs. We believe that families are better served by flexible systems that are able to customize their services based on the family's need and the level of risk. And when all of that is done, we believe that communities are enriched by stronger families. And if you would indulge me for just a moment, I'm a visual person, and as I was making my trip here from Fossil this morning, I was trying to visually see what it is that I think I've learned and heard over several months now of discussion with all of the people in this room. And it would appear to me that if you look at my hands, and each one of my fingers is a service or a program or an agency. And that service may be in a state agency, it may be in a local agency, it may be in education, it may be in public health. Who knows where it is? But as you can see right now, this is how it looks to me. They're there, but they're randomly touching and inconsistently touching from county to county, depending upon what's there and what isn't there. And there's a lot of gaps, as you can see, between the fingers. Plus, there isn't a whole lot of support to those fingers. Those fingers are very vulnerable and unstable. But if we do what I think is being proposed in this plan, if we put the fingers like this so that they're consistently touching in every county and their support, each finger is offering strength and support to the next finger, we then have a less vulnerable and a more stable system that can offer stability to our most vulnerable and at-risk families. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Donna Schnitker, and I'm from Harney County. I am a director of an Oregon Head Start program. Here speaking on behalf of the Head Start community in support of Senate Bill 555. Head Start, 30 years ago when it was established, one of the cornerstones was working with community partners in a collaborative arrangement. And we believe that Senate Bill 555 supports the collaborative arrangements that are already happening at a local level. We can't serve the families that we do, the high-risk, low-income families, unless we work together with our community partners to make sure our families are receiving all the services they need to be successful and have good outcomes. So the Head Start community does support Senate Bill 555.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? We will excuse you then and invite Judy Newman, Gerald Stiles, and Anita here. And they'll be followed by Senator Dresser. If we could also send a note to Senator Byers. He's in here in your seating on his
Good afternoon. My name is Judy Newman, and I'm the chairperson of the State Interagency Coordinating Council, which is the statutorily mandated advisory committee for early intervention and early childhood special education programs in Oregon. I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 555-3 with a specific focus on the early childhood system. And today I'm actually representing a partnership, and Cheryl Stiles was mentioned and Craig Campbell, and the three of us are the chairs of three of the advisory groups that represent the three largest programs serving young Oregonians in early childhood services. The first one, we have been meeting together over the last year and a half as chairs and as membership at large to collaborate on our efforts. The first program is for the Healthy Start the Healthy Start Wellness Committee of the Commission on Children and Families. Craig Campbell chairs that committee. The second one is for the Head Start Oregon Pre-Kindergarten, Together for Children. And the third is for the Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Ed Program. And we've been meeting together to do a couple things. First of all, the membership of our groups represent the four main components that you need for a comprehensive plan. You need to represent health, you need to represent education, you need to represent child care and families. And in order to do a comprehensive integrated plan, all those components need to be there talking about what works for an early childhood system for young kids. Our collaboration over the last year and a half has identified common outcomes and standards for early childhood system and partners in the process as well, and now we're moving towards working on the content for a plan and a process. We've been linking very closely with the home visiting effort that was just described to you, and what's happening is that these efforts are really coming together in a strong collaboration. What we just want to communicate to you today, and my partners asked me to do this, is the language in Senate Bill 555-3 allows us to really build on these existing collaborations, and it truly does have a unifying effect. It stays away from language that puts one group over another and which can be divisive and really undermine existing collaborations, and we really can't afford to do that, to go backwards. So we support the inclusiveness and the flexibility of Senate Bill 555, and we look forward to hopefully assisting us in our future efforts so we can continue.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Anita McClanahan, Director of Early Childhood Programs in the Department of Education. I was just thinking, I wanted to tell you, I knew Carol Stiles couldn't come, and I wanted to apologize for her. She asked me to do that. That went through my brain and made me almost forget my name.
The same Carol Stiles
you know very well, Senator Bryant. Yes. She just couldn't make it over the hill today, she said. I'm here representing the Department of Ed, and I would like to report that we support Senate Bill 555-3 for three main reasons. First, we see this bill as a unifying organizer for collaborative partnership, and we see that it supports the existing efforts in Oregon communities, many of which you've already heard about this afternoon. Secondly, we believe that it presents a systems approach to crime prevention beginning with early childhood. And I know many of you had the opportunity to attend the brain research workshops that were provided at the beginning of the legislative session. And there certainly is an enormous amount of research that supports our need to really intervene at the earliest possible time with children and families. And we certainly see this in this bill. And thirdly, we support Senate Bill 555-3 because we believe it provides the supports for the Department of Education's unique role and statutory responsibilities for programs and services that the department is charged with providing for children and families. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Senator Gerflin. Good afternoon.
Thank you. It is a nice afternoon. It's all the blue skies.
Funny how we forget that there's a world out there.
Yeah, I know. My name is Gene Gerflin. I'm a senator from Salem area, District 16. And I have to tell you a little bit about, maybe press my background. I go back a long ways in this particular industry. I chaired Juvenile Services Commission in Marion County back, I think, in 1980. Or 82 on there when I first was on there, and I chaired that for 4 years and learned a lot about, I think, the programs that we presented and found that the counties, in my opinion, did a much better job than state agencies where we were allowed to get the money down into the communities, and we were providing programs where we had a lot of good volunteers that I think gave a lot of services for the dollars we spent. When I got into the legislature, I also got involved and I chaired the family or the Oregon child care team, which many people refer back to. We spent about 14 months studying the children's issues, and I think I spent about 40 hours a week on it for the 14 months that I was there. And I think I learned a lot about programs for kids. And I think
you might say who your committee administrator was for that committee.
Was it Robin?
Yeah, it was Robin Carr-Morris, yes, it was. Yeah. She was the advisor for that committee, yes.
She's a pretty good person to spend
Years with. And she brought a tremendous amount of resources. We had Dr. Brazelton came out one time and addressed our committee. And the things that I learned about what we need to do for kids, Dr. Brazelton says he can interview an 18-month-old baby and tell within 80% of the time whether the kids can be a failure or a success. And if you read any of the latest books on brain development, 95% of the brain is formed the first 18 months of life. And the things that happened, as an example, in Colorado, things that happened in Springfield, those personalities were formed perhaps when the kids were 6 months old, or 9 months old. I mean, those are the kind of things that are happening to our kids. We have an excellent system down at the University of Oregon on childhood development. And if you listen to them, they will tell you if you don't address a kid's problems before he's in the third grade, the dollars you spend after are not effective. They do very, very well good. And I know the governor, I absolutely disagree on the direction that he wishes to go, and that is on 11 to 17, the spending dollars on those kids, in my opinion, are not effective. You don't make much change in them. I mean, you may save 2, 3, or 4% of them, but you're not going to make a big difference in outcomes. Where you're going to make a difference is in the early childhood. When you start working with the dysfunctional families, even when before the kids are born, and we started the program after we did the child care team. We're the ones who proposed the Healthy Start program. It was a program that we visited in Hawaii. It was a very successful program where they would work with the dysfunctional families. And you don't need to do a lot. You need to teach a lot of families. And I think every mother wants the best for their kid. I'm not disputing that. But a lot of them don't know how to get there. And you need to do just basic things like how to clean a house, how to cook, how to budget, how to cook a meal, parenting classes. Those kinds of instructions will stop an awful lot of the things that happen in Colorado and in Springfield and those areas. So, and the natural tendency, and I've watched it for many years now, the natural tendency is for the dollars to go to the squeaky wheel, and the squeaky wheel is the 11 to 17 group. There's no question, because that's where the problems are caused. But we're always, in this system, we're always working at the effect, and we're never working at the cause. And the cause is because we don't work with the children in early childhood. And it's hard to get the dollars down there. I don't care what you do, even this committee can push very hard to get the dollars into the early childhood programs, and it will gradually go back to 11-17, because, again, that's where the problems are. That's where you hear about them. But if you're going to make any difference in this program, if you're going to get to the effect, you've got to work at the cause, and the cause is early childhood. And you have to fight like mad to get dollars in there. We continually are pushing the dollars the other direction. And I've been a real advocate for a long time to get the dollars in the 0 to 3. And I've talked really hard with the local commissions, and I think they've agreed now they are going to work more on the 0 to 6. We didn't get them down to 3, but at least we got them to 0 to 6. Again, that's where you're going to make a difference, and that's where you're going to get a change in direction, that you don't have to build these juvenile facilities when the kids get to be 11 to 17. I just would really advise the committee, because I've worked really hard on it, and I'm going to continue to work hard. We did pass the bill 2004, where we wanted the family resource centers, again, where we wanted them near the schools, where the dysfunctional families could go and get respite care and get instruction, training classes. You're not going to get a dysfunctional family to call CSC and say, gee, we've got a problem, can you come help us? Because they're very fearful of going to government. But if you could make a friendly place near a school where families feel comfortable to go to, and get the praying classes and get the instructions that they need to have a good family, you're going to make a tremendous difference in the long run if you can do that. So I would just tell you very strongly that you need to get the dollars in early childhood if you're going to make a difference in these programs. And I'd invite you to read some of the new books. I think, Kate, you went to that meeting we had in Portland of how the brain develops, and there's some excellent books out.
that if you, these habits are formed very, very early in life. You don't change them. I know we need a continuum of services. You got to address the kids from 0 to 18. But I would just implore you to get the direction in early childhood. That's really going to make a difference. So, with that, I'll answer any questions that I can.
Questions for Senator Burford. Senator Brown has a question for you.
I can't resist. Okay. You said the squeaky wheel gets the grease, and I tend to agree with you. And I think over the last several decades, the squeaky wheels have been the young men, the violent men,
mm-hmm.
and those that haven't gotten services were the young women. If we ignore these young women, what we end up creating is a whole new generation of problems. Don't you think we should be spending some money on the young women, if nothing else?
As I mentioned before, I don't care what you do, the money is going to gradually go to that group because you don't see the results when you spend the money in early childhood. It takes 6 or 8 or 10 years before you get a result. And so the money just is normally going to go to that, and you'll have to fight like mad to keep the money in early childhood.
Thank
you, Senator.
Thank you very much.
Next we have Barbara. And Barbara, I know how I pronounced your name before, but I'm not going to try today. I apologize. Mm-hmm. And Jeff Ryan. Together? You'll follow Barbara.
Yeah. I was just turning on my power here.
All right. No, I'm glad to do it. And you know I'm Senator.
Oh, yeah. For the record, I'm Barbara Stamaglio, Director of the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. Thank you, Senator Bryant, and members of the committee. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 555-3 and to reiterate that alcohol and drug issues are a critical link in the problem of juvenile and adult violence. When we talk about early childhood, alcohol and drug issues are a critical factor in troubled families. We know that if families are not able to get the kind of support they need to address these problems, it affects the children for the rest of their lives oftentimes. Research shows that not only is there a strong link between alcohol and drug issues and crime and violence, but also that treatment is an effective deterrent and an effective intervention. In study after study that has come out in recent years, we consistently see improvement in families and in individuals after treatment has been given. Senate Bill 555-3 recognizes that there are needs for improvements in the way that we offer treatment in the state of Oregon. One of the biggest problems that I've observed is that there is a disconnect between how we plan for alcohol and drug services and how we plan for some of the other family services that are delivered by other DHR agencies as well as other local entities. Senate Bill 555-3 allows an opportunity to bring these planning processes together so that we are, in fact, looking at the whole family and not delivering the services piecemeal. We recognize that additional resources put into the alcohol and drug area are needed, but also with that, it's essential that the planning be coordinated at both the state and local level so that those resources are appropriately directed toward those families and young people who need them and who are at greatest risk in their local communities. And so, again, this Senate bill offers an opportunity to bring those planning processes together so that we can better offer these important and needed services to the families and young people who most need them. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Barbara? And again, too, the coordination is going to be important. We have a new benchmark for you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. And while Jeff's coming up, my tentative plan is that we will work this week from Monday. We might do it in the evening. And
my goal would be to have a good work session and some ideas on amendments and things, and if we're successful, to send it down to Ways and Means. Good afternoon, Jeff. Are you ready?
I am, Senator. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Jeffrey Tryons. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Progress Board. My job today is to give you an overview, to talk about evaluation, a little bit to talk about evaluation overall, and then to look at how it would affect and be part of the various initiatives that you're looking at this afternoon. There are really four reasons to evaluate a program or to conduct these kinds of evaluations. One is the obvious, to assure that the dollars are spent as effectively as possible. We all want to know that the money that is being spent is being used wisely. Not only is it not being misspent, but we're having the results we want to achieve. We also can learn more about what works through evaluations. That's another very important reason for having evaluations in these kind of programs. Who's succeeding? We also are able to, with this program, which so depends on coordination, both at the local level and between the state and local level, by structuring the evaluation, we can reinforce the need for coordination with others. And lastly, and probably most importantly, by structuring an evaluation properly, we can help local agencies, local groups, be more effective with their dollars by making sure that they use the data that they're using in their evaluation process to improve their own processes, by asking them the kinds of questions like, what are you learning from the data? How is it affecting what you do?
One of my goals for the Progress Board is to have the information they gather relevant at the local level. Well, it's just not our tool to measure, but also have information available locally. We're not doing very well in the lights. Let me turn this down. And move on.
I'm sorry, Senator. I didn't want to cut out your sunshine. If you hit that, is that readable, Senator? There we go.
Okay, just decide one or the other.
Okay, let's leave it like that. We have roles and responsibilities here for three of the groups that would be involved in any of these new initiatives that you're looking at. One is the body that's going to do the coordination at the state level. They would be responsible for establishing and reviewing the assessment criteria, for reviewing outcome information, for assuring that the criteria is met, and then for reporting to the legislature overall on particular successes and how we're doing overall. There would be a university-based group of technical assistants who would work with the local groups to help them to set up evaluation frameworks. It's not easy to do this, to assist in creating a local evaluation infrastructure, if you will, so the groups are actually able to carry out this evaluation, and then to receive and review the individual plans. And then the Progress Board's role would be to be looking at overall evaluations. How are we doing in achieving the outcomes? When we add up all of the parts of this program, is it actually achieving those outcomes that we want to see as part of the plan? We'd be involved in helping to structure the way those outcomes are evaluated and then looking at them overall. This is very important because really when you look at a local program, it links into starting with kind of the Oregon Shines, the big vision, the big goal to have a safe, caring, and engaged community. We go all the way through the safe and the crime and the juvenile and then the prevention part of that and then into one particular aspect of it, for instance, like the use of drugs, as you were hearing about a moment ago, and that gets us down into programs. So we have individual program performance evaluations. How's that program working? But then at these higher levels, we can look at how it's working as a system. What effect is it having on these higher level outcomes, which is what we really care about? Traditionally, the way a program has operated is you establish the goal, you have the initiative, you have the agency working on it, you have the program, and then all the way down at the bottom is where you see your indicators of success. We've been working with state agencies here in Oregon for about a year now to change that around. So we have the benchmarks up here, what it is where the big high-level outcomes, societal outcomes, and then what we call interim indicators, which I'll explain a little bit more about in a minute, and then those actual agency measures of their success. But why do we need interim indicators? Well, the big problem we've had in Oregon ever since we had the benchmarks was we have these high-level outcomes, like reducing the crime rate, and then we have agencies that were measuring their own workloads. But the gap between those two things was so huge that agencies had a hard time saying that, yes, we're responsible for reducing the crime rate because so many other external influences have an effect on that. So what we've been able to do is create, and this is one of the areas where we've been able to do the most work, is to create a set of what we call interim indicators that are joint action, allowing agencies and others to step out of the box of saying, well, I don't want to be held responsible for anything I don't control. To saying instead, the literature shows that if we can achieve these larger things as partners, that we can have an impact on the benchmark. So we've created a set of interim indicators, if you will, that agencies have now signed up for. And if you look at the Juvenile Prevention Initiative, we have in a whole series of areas linked agencies hand in hand on affecting a set of indicators that they can have an influence over. Now, I haven't got the time to run through all these with you, but you have it. You have this in your handout, and if you want to review these, all the agencies who are involved in this have actually worked through this. Progress Board would be happy to spend some more time with you on that. And then the performance measures that agencies have link up into those interim indicators, which link up into the benchmarks. So we're creating a linked way of judging performance from top right down to agency level. And then what I wanted to do last is just to give you as part of the handout of what each of those indicator levels is. I'm going to turn it over now to talk about the specific initiative to the next speaker, who...
Yes, Bill here.
Hi, Herm.
And Jeff, you're satisfied that the language in the -3 amendments gives you the authority, the jurisdiction, the clout you need in order to do this?
I am very satisfied with that, Senator, yes.
Okay.
And we've worked very closely with this group over well over a year now to help to get this in place. He's going to use my – we're coordinating here.
Okay.
If you would just give me this, I'll just open it for you.
We'll need the lights off again. We have a second. And for those on local commissions and in agencies, I'm not requesting this or requiring it to make the life more difficult or to have you say, oh, God, another report I have to do. I think it's important to planning and then for measurements in order for you to get your funding. So I hope you find it both helpful once you get through the difficult task of putting it together, and it'll hopefully be easy. All right, Jeff?
Yes, sir. Oh, this has just been a piece of cake putting this together, believe me. No, there's a lot of work in it, but we believe that it in fact is worth the effort, really well worth the effort. Yeah, I'm not a PowerPoint user. I don't know how to hit slides here.
Different languages. Yeah.
Here we go. Here it is right here. There you go.
I think someone from MIT could do that.
I did it. You just hit that button.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, my name is Bill Feierherm. I'm the Vice Provost for Research and Dean of Graduate Studies at Portland State University. More importantly for our purposes today,
I'm trained as a criminologist. I have 30 years of experience in doing research and evaluation in the juvenile justice arena. I've been participating in the design of this project for over the past year and a half. And I hope to give you a quick overview of it today that shows you the ways in which it is consistent with the structure that Jeff outlined. The basic structure or the basic logic of our approach to evaluation is to look at the five risk factors that have been identified that you see on the left-hand side of the screen, to measure each of those and to measure their contribution to the overall objective meeting the benchmark. You'll notice in the slide that I've moved the area of substance abuse out somewhat and that you have different colored arrows. The reason for doing that is to note to you that, in fact, this evaluation process serves not only to look at juvenile crime issues, but also to look at the substance issues that Barbara Somazio outlined for you earlier. In effect, what we're able to do is to use the same or many of the same data collection processes, the same data sources, to assess multiple parts of the material that's in front of you today in 555-3. We believe that it's important that we assess this not only at the community level, which is the level at which we have most of the data which is collected in this state, but that we consider two other levels. Those youth who fit the kind of program definite or target definition that Steve Carmichael gave to you, it talks about individuals who are either in the system or at imminent danger of being in the system, as well as assessing the impact of these programs on the center of this circle, the kids who are actually in programs that are participating. We need to make assessments at all of those levels and to assess our progress at all of those levels, understanding that the program may be have a great deal of impact in the center of that circle, but because we're looking at a small number of kids, may not be reflected in overall community measures. So we really need not to hold a small program accountable for making a change in a large community, but to track the progress that it does make. In tracking that progress, we're depending upon multiple sources of information. Basically, we have three columns here. Agency data refers to all of the information which we currently collect through a variety of sources, FCF, LEDs, etc. We're making heavy reliance on the school survey that the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs has been conducting for some time. We've modified the survey. That survey has been conducted by Mike Finnegan, Northwest Professional Consortium, and with Mike's collaboration, we've modified that survey to fit not only the needs of alcohol and drug issues, but also looking at juvenile crime issues. From that survey, we can generate estimates not only for the general community, the, if you will, blue row in this, but also we can generate estimates for the targeted youth who fit that definition that Steve and Larry gave to you. Finally, using the model of that same instrument, what we've designed is what I'm calling here a participant data or survey form that gets the same information from juveniles who are participating in these prevention programs. We then have an ability to compare across types of programs as well as types of levels of analysis as I presented to you before. There are a number of slides that I'm going to go through relatively quickly, very quickly. We'll see how fast Jeff's computer is. Basically because they give you information that Jeff referenced already, this information we don't really have time to go through. I simply want you to know that we have specific measures for each of the indicators that we've outlined, and that we've done that looking not only at agency information, but also within the survey data. Finally, what I want to point out to you is a relatively innovative assessment process looking at what we're calling a network analysis. You've heard of the kinds of coordination that Pam talked about early on, that others have talked about throughout. We've discovered ways of measuring those levels of collaboration and describing the relationship between agencies within a given county. By looking at those relationships, we can describe, using quantitative measures, the fragmentation of the service delivery system within a given community. We can describe the density, in other words, the reverse of fragmentation.
We can also describe the centrality of various types of agencies. In other words, what we can do is not only describe outcomes for individual kids, but we can describe the changes in the service delivery systems that go about, given the kinds of changes that you see in, that are outlined in the Dash 3 amendment.
Have you tested this? Have you run this analysis in Oregon?
We have run this analysis in the area of mental health services, looking at children's mental health services, particularly looking at what was called the Oregon Partners Project that looked within Multnomah County at delivery of services to severely and chronically disabled kids long term. But you get the picture. We're looking at kids with very serious mental health problems. We completed that analysis. We have not completed similar analyses looking at juvenile crime issues.
Right, it's so we're sitting here, and rather than it being April of 1999, it's April 2001. We funded the $57 million, and now the legislature says, okay, we want to see some results. Show us the analysis, show us how we can do the best benchmarks and the measurements. Will you be able to do that in 2 years?
Mr. Chair, we have designed a survey that will be going out shortly that will give us the baseline against which to compare information. We'll then have a follow-up survey at intervals that should give us, by the time we come back in 2 years, we should have three data points in order to answer your question and in order to show the kinds of change in this arena. We will have at least two data points to show you the kinds of changes with respect to the direct juvenile outcomes that we were describing and that I was describing in previous slides.
And I realize this is more of a longitudinal study than that. I mean, it takes more time. It's a generational change, but taxpayers and legislators or policymakers are sometimes have a short vision. That's why it's important to begin having the basis covered in 2 years. Also, I'd hope that this type of work is something that we can find funding for in other areas through National Institute of Justice, those places, because I know they're fascinated with this type of progressive review.
One last item, Mr. Chair, and that is a designation of some of the responsibilities in the for conducting the evaluation. As you can see, we're taking on a fair amount of responsibility on behalf of the state at the university level. We're also depending on county partners to actually go collect the data to engage in those surveys. One last point, and that is that we don't have enough detail to break it out here, but in the item where we're saying providing the profile of archival survey and program data, what we have outlined are analyses, separate analyses by racial and cultural group and by gender group, so that within 2 years we will be able to describe information that will address the kinds of questions that Senator Brown posed earlier, the kinds of issues that you heard Marco and Lonnie and others describe. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions to the doctor? Thank you for your testimony. We're now ready for lights, and also for Senator Byer.
We'll present good policy. People do it for good policy, and then the bad will be down in their knees. I would hope that we can come up with a recommendation that we would like to make, and then go along with the heck.
Senator Byer. My squeaky voice and trying not to have a conversation with Senator Courtney covered in records. I wasn't loud enough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Your voice isn't the only one that's there. I think we've got a little bit of a frog going through the building. Well, my comments are going to be more general. I know you've been hearing the technical stuff, and I wanted to share with you, I mentioned the other day an article that sort of got my blood boiling a little bit, and I just wanted to share that with you to make sure that you had seen that. My reaction to that, and it's really one of saying, where, as the legislature, the 70th Assembly, what are we going to do to answer this
this problem that's in front of us. And I guess I would start out by saying that I think that this is one of those things. It's not a question of how much money do we have. It's what do we need to spend to do as much as we can. You've heard a lot of the technical testimony today, and probably will hear much more. I think over the last year, this state has focused more attention on looking at the problems of crime and violence among youth. We have probably the best array of experts in the nation, in Oregon, in our universities. This is not a question of not knowing what to do. It's a question of having the will to do something. And I think we have a lot of that in front of us. Now, I know under the governor's proposal he has put forth, I was involved with the League of Oregon Cities, Association of Counties, and the schools, frankly, under the initiation of Mayors Torrey and then Morissette of Springfield and Eugene, to get a group together statewide and look and come up with regional plans. And those have been done. I'm not going to say that I would necessarily, if I were drawing up the plan, do it exactly the way the various leaders in my community put it together, but I will say that I think it is a reasonable and productive strategy that's been put forth, and I would hope that you would consider that, along with the plans from the other regions, as a good starting point of the least that we can do. There are other elements besides just the funding pieces. They go to, in my community, Judge Darrell Larson's drug court. Now, you may think that that's a stretch, but many of the problems that young children have are the effects of parents being involved in drug and alcohol problems. Across the land, courts like Judge Larson's have proven to have the most effect on reducing recidivism or reuse of those of any strategy that we've seen by all the studies that I've seen. Yet, Judge Larson's court, unless we change the funding system, will be out of funds and will not be able to operate. And I know there are others in Oregon like that. Senators, we can't let that happen. The price of dealing with that one is fairly reasonable, and I know you have a proposal in front of you on the, I forget what they call it, but the charges on the fines. That's something you have to do. Beyond that is the guns and the holding of youth who bring guns to schools, and I know you're looking at those. I'm not going to go into great details. I just wanted to take the time to urge you as the lead committee to please consider these things, and let's do the right thing. It's important that we do that. We can't let these situations continue to happen, and they're just, as we've seen in the last week, happening all too frequently, and I think everything that we know just from our heart is that they will continue to happen unless the leaders in this country do something. So I urge you to take the right step. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee, and to give you some optimism, the whole bill be up Monday. The Senate recording will carry that. I think that will be, I'd be surprised if it's unanimous. We passed out a family court bill that's important. That's the other ways and means, and we hope that we can get that funded. It's not included in the governor's budget, but it serves the same purpose, that a little different group, but the same purpose as the drug courts and the other juvenile type courts. And the good news is, and we have to remember this, the governor's initial budget and the Senate Republican budget both included $30 million for criminal justice, $20 million for drug and alcohol enhancement. And I think the Senate budget was slightly higher increase in early childhood intervention and development. So policy-wise, early on, there was agreement on the money even, and now, as we go down to the Ways and Means process, it's just holding on to that and battling it out with the other good causes on how to invest.
I agree.
We'll need your help on
that. Let's hope that the people on the other side of the building agree with us. Thank you very much, Senator.
Yeah.
It is Friday, Peter.
We'll now go into more of the public testimony, and I have a list here. It's the policy of the Senate to have those who come the furthest distance testify first, just so they don't have to come back. So let me invite up Mike Derman from the Deschutes County Children's Commission on Families, Tom Schaefer from Hood River Commission on Families, and Randy Frankie, although he's not that far away. He signed up for the same group. So you're lucky to be hanging around with these other people, else you'd be here for a while longer.
Yeah,
have to apologize. I need to head out. So my apologies. It's not...
So I think we're about to say, but Jenny, could you give us the sunlight back? Thank you.
We will.
And that will be, we'll follow next with Gillian Nicolaides from Douglas County, Mira Bolton, Multnomah County, Mike, Serini from Harney, and Judy Gmakin from Coos County. So, who'd like to begin? Randy?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Bryant, Senators. My name is Randy Franke. I'm a commissioner from Marion County, Oregon. I've had the pleasure of serving that position for 20 years now. I also chair the Marion County Children and Families Commission, and I am the chair of the local coalition of children and families commissions from around the state. That's a relatively new organization, and we represent all the local children and family commissions in the 36 counties. I will start with my chair of the local coalition hat on, if you will, and with a couple of brief comments before I move to Marion County. First of all, the coalition has not had an opportunity to review Senate Bill 555, really either the dash threes or the dash fours in their entirety. So we don't have a position as a coalition on the entirety of the bill. However, we have worked hard on the juvenile justice component of that, and we are on record as supporting that high-risk juvenile justice initiative, and we remain supportive of that component of the bill. We also have a position on Healthy Start that we have taken, and that is it's our first priority to support the rollout of Healthy Start to all 36 counties and the appropriate funding of that program so that it's fully funded in each of those counties. Mm-hmm. We have had a small group of local directors that were able to convene when 555's first rendition was made available, and they have looked at it and had some concerns surrounding the language in rewriting parts of House Bill 2004, and that small group of directors did submit some suggested amendments, mainly focusing on the rewrite of 2004 provisions, and I'm not sure they may or may not be in Dash 4. I just got a copy of Dash 4 today, so I couldn't look at it close enough to tell if all those suggested had been incorporated into those Dash 4 comments, but I did see several changes in line with some of our directors' concerns. So that would be
on the Dash 4 amendment.
On the Dash 4 amendment.
And if you could give us your full comments sometime on Monday, that would be most helpful.
Okay, well, yes, we didn't have time to get written comments in time, and we'll follow up with that. I'm now going to take my hat off as the chair of the coalition, and you're now listening to me as a Marion County Commissioner and chair of the Marion County Children and Families Commission. We support strongly the juvenile crime initiative piece in this legislation. And we support a lot of what I would say the goals that I heard discussed this morning, or this afternoon. It's been quite that long, I guess. But, you know, with the idea of getting everybody to local tables so you have a comprehensive plan that involves state agencies as well as local programs is certainly a goal we support, and we believe it was first envisioned in House Bill 2004. Again, we concur with the concerns that other directors have established on some of that language in there on rewriting 2004. And if push came to shove today and you were going to make a vote, we know you're not, but if you were and you were asking our opinion, we would say we support Dash 4 as opposed to Dash 3 at the moment on regarding those concerns about the language around 2004. Let me just say as an overview and remind people, I mean, we really feel strongly that the vision that the 93 legislature had when they created House Bill 2004, if I remember right, it had Dash 34 before we finally got it passed through the legislature. you were really ahead of your time, and you still are with that piece of legislation. Oregon is viewed as a leader in this country. And I don't care who you talk to, they talk about states. There's 10 states usually mentioned that are doing some innovative things and different things that have a better impact on kids and families. And Oregon is always mentioned in that group, that elite group. And the reason they're mentioned is the vision in House Bill 2004. And just to touch on it briefly, I think the strengths that we saw in there, really it was about doing business differently than we had traditionally done in providing services. We think the legislature was right in having that vision then, and we think you are still right to maintain that vision. It created a unique partnership between the state commission and local commissions in each county. It even provided the opportunity that most counties have taken advantage of as a partnership between the county level and at the community level. So the list of people, most of the counties have taken this to the community, involved the community members in this process. It created the concept of wellness or an assets and strengths-based approach at looking at these issues instead of a deficit model of looking at kids with problems all the time and looking at kids as an asset and families as an asset in developing solutions. It focused on outcomes for the first time, using the benchmarks as a starting point, and we've continually looked at refining how we measure outcomes. And many of us have been working with some of those university-based folks, such as Clara Pratt out of Oregon State University, in looking at how we develop some of those interim indicators that Jeff talked about. It also provided flexibility where local communities could focus on what they needed to do in terms of their local problems at the same time as we dealt with the statewide issues. And I guess the final strength that I would mention, I think it provided a focus on community and family, not just government dollars and government programs as the solution to the problems that we see with children and families today. And I think that's proven time and time again, as we see more and more, to be a visionary approach. If you look at what Boston has done, the tremendous efforts they did in reducing their gang problem and shooting in Boston, it was a comprehensive community approach that involved the faith community and businesses and all aspects of the community, along with government. And that really was the vision in 2004. It is as valid today as it was the day this legislature passed that legislation. Our concerns, again, are around the detail of the language regarding state and local commissions. And we're concerned is any superseding of House Bill 2004 in those rewrites. We're concerned about the language and the vision regarding wellness, and there's a lot of talk in the draft about risk and risk focus and dealing with the kids at higher risk. Now, I'm not going to argue that when we've got government dollars and government programs, we're going to, at some point, set priorities. So we don't have enough money to do everything, and certainly it's appropriate to look at risk in that sense. But we can't do the community mobilization and the community planning part based on risk. We've got a plan for all children and all families, and we can't separate out just at risk. It includes at risk, but not just at risk. And finally, our concern in some of the language, again, in 555-3 is around the potential issue and understanding and support for community mobilization. A lot of Children and Families Commissions have spent a lot of time creating partnerships in local communities with churches, with schools and other organizations, including families. And we don't want to see any of that work eliminated or roadblocks thrown up in our ability to address those concerns and continue that community-based approach. I could list things we've done, but I don't want to take all that time up. Let me just end with a quote that I think sums up the issue about as well as I've heard it summed up. And it comes out of a gentleman named David Crislip and Carl Larson. And in a book called Collaborative Leadership, they state this: simply making government more efficient and consumer-driven in delivering services ignores the desires of citizens to have a larger role in public life and to act as partners with government in addressing the needs of the community. Reinventing government, or governance may be a more appropriate term, may go beyond a more efficient and responsive service delivery. It must fundamentally change the relationship of citizens and government. Again, we see that as one of the strengths that 2004 allows us to do. And while we strive to implement a juvenile crime initiative and to do some things that do need to be done, we don't want to lose that strength in 2004. Thank you.
And 2003.
Right.
So we'll now turn to 2003 and Mike Durman. And Randy, if you could give up your seat to Mayor Sween. I understand he has to leave in a few minutes.
Would be pleased.
Thank you. So, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mike Durman. And my occupation, I am not a professional associated with Commissions on Children and Families. I am the director of the Aerospace Industry Association of Oregon. And I am a layperson on Deschutes County's 15-member lay commission for children and families. I'm also the vice chair of the local commission for children and families that Randy talked to earlier. My presentation today and my testimony relates to Deschutes County specifically. I want to explain to you first, though, before I get into which dash version I'm here to support, why I am involved with my local commission. I'm a father of two children, a four-year-old and a two-year-old. I am a member of the faith community and very active. And it seems that my yard becomes every afternoon the Kool-Aid house for football and baseball, and there's about 30 kids tearing up my lawn. So I know many of the children in the neighborhood and their parents very closely. All too often, though, I also see people I don't know or that are close neighbors of mine who appear to be suffering neglect, abuse, and as well as their children. And this inspired me to look for an avenue to get involved at a local level to help my community out. When I learned about the local Commission on Children and Families in 2004, I thought this was a great avenue to use my energies to help make a difference at a local level. The reason I'm here today is because I see some language in some of the amendments that are being offered that would take away from the energy that I want to give and the other 14 members of our commission. Specifically, referring back to testimony that was offered earlier today to this committee, someone said in support of Dash 3, that Dash 3 does not preclude local input and mobility. That's right. But Dash 3 does not proactively go after the people at a local level that know their neighbors, that know their children, and seek their input and proactively use their wisdom and their efforts and their energies in the business community to come up with creative solutions that are inherent to that community. That is why I'm here today, because I want to support Dash 4 and use that as a building block for the future. I ask that you allow us not only to do our planning at a local level, but to give us the empowerment to follow through on that planning, to allow us to use some of the dollars that have been talked about to do full-spectrum program implementation. Yes, there are high-risk people that need attention right now, but our county and its voters have already set aside $8 million for our juvenile detention center to work with the high-risk individuals. Okay. Our citizens, our voters, our committees have all been planning and planning and planning. Mr. Chair, as you know, we've been planning year after year. I mean, there's 180 pages of planning here that we've done. We're ready to implement and come up with creative programs to reach all levels that need our attention. So I ask that you give us the flexibility to address everyone at every age that needs our help so that we can have a healthy community. I also ask that you allow us to be efficient and lean in our delivery. In the Dash 4 Amendment, there are some language about a consolidated grant program, and I applaud you for putting that in there. That will help us work with one government agency as a team and do specific deliverables that meet all the needs of all the government agencies that we need to report to without having to come up with multiple reports and multiple time on the phone when we can concentrate on service delivery. Without flexibility and creativity at the local level, we would not have such programs as Family Court, which are making a big impact on our community right now. Yes, a lot of coordination can be done at the state level, but it is really the people on the ground, or if I may steal a phrase from the aerospace industry, self-directed work teams. In the industry, general managers and CEOs know what the airplane wants to look like. They know how it wants to fly. But they look to the shop floor of the people on the front line to help with the very specific engineering and the implementation. It is those people at the front lines that only know if the machine is going to be able to make that part. And so too here, Dash 4 is the basis for allowing the people on the front line in the communities to deal one-on-one with their neighbors and their children. So I ask for that empowerment and to allow us to move forward. With that being said, I think I'd just like to close with a quote from Governor McCall. He said, "Heroes are not giant statues framed against a red sky. They are people who say, this is my community, and it's my responsibility to make it better. In an age where we are striving to find role models and heroes, I think that we should take every opportunity to meet those people in the community that are willing to step forward and take their creativity, their wisdom, and their resources and push it to the next level. Thank you for this opportunity."
Thank you, Mike. And if you wouldn't mind allowing the good mayor to speak, because I understand you have to return to your hometown. So, Mayor Swain, why don't you...
And my hometown, Chairman Ryan, certainly is the city of Salem, but it's my office. It's my office that beckons me on a Friday that I need to finish some work. But Sarah Bryant and members of the committee, I do appreciate the courtesy of being able to be here and to testify. My name for the record is Mike Swaim. I am the mayor of Salem and also a member of the board of directors of the League of Oregon Cities. And after former Mayor Bill Morissette from Springfield joined the legislature, I became co-chair of the At-Risk Youth Committee. Let me just offer a couple of observations. I think they're pertinent, at least from the perspective of the most local government, being city governments, but also from some philosophical points of view. Senator Gerkler spoke to you earlier, of course, and he said that I think it was Dr. Brazeltine or something like that said that he could interview children of 18 months of age and determine essentially whether they were going to be productive or non-productive members of society. And, you know, Senator Gerkler is absolutely correct in that. And Senator Brown talked about the fact that certainly by investing in young women, that would have a very noticeable and measurable impact on some of the issues that we're talking about here. And she's correct. And in fact, I would submit to you that I could talk, and certainly someone more professional than I in the field could interview a set of parents for a period of time and probably be able to predict in many instances with a fair degree of probability whether their offspring yet to be conceived are going to be troublesome for the community. And I say that from a background of nearly 30 years, which involved the practice of criminal law as well as others. And I've handled and been involved in one role or another of a dozen and a half murder cases. And I've seen the pre-sentence investigation reports, and I've seen these kids as troublesome in the materials that have been brought forward for the sentencing process, from school truants to McLaren graduates to OSCI to OSP. And it's just predictable. The fact of the matter is, the bottom line is that this is a very complex and multifaceted problem. And the answer is not going to be any particular program or any particular strategy, no matter how well thought out, no matter how well funded. The answer is going to be multifaceted and complex as well. And it was kind of with that observation that the League of Oregon Cities, through the initiation of Bill Morissette and Mayor Torrey, Jim Torrey, set up the At-Risk Youth Committee. And they brought in members from, and they held regional meetings, and brought in members from cities, counties, schools, school boards, state legislatures, Senator Byers being one of those, state, county, and city agencies, the governor's office, attorney general's office, and congressional delegation. And we had tie-ins to the Criminal Justice Commission, Department of Ed, Juvenile Directors Association, OIA, Juvenile Criminal Prevention Advisory Committee, and it goes on and on and on.
But the idea was to get a better picture of exactly what was going on. From that committee, we took the recommendations to the legislative committee of the LOC, which comprised of 60 mayors and city councilors, and it was unanimously approved that we needed to move forward in these kinds of strategies that are evidenced in Senate Bill 555. From there, we went to the annual convention in November, and it was overwhelmingly the position of the General Convention of the League of Oregon Cities that youth was a very and probably the highest priority in terms of what we needed to invest in the state of Oregon. And certainly the high-risk juvenile prevention partnership piece of that is an important piece, and cities certainly need to be a partner, and I agree with my presenter here in that respect. We also are firm believers in the collaborative approach here in Marion County. I took Randy Frankie's seat. We have a group we call the Youth Compact, which is made up of representatives of Marion Polk County, the school district, and Salem and Kaiser, the city of Salem and Kaiser. And we had, and just to give you just one example, we had a situation with a consequence of measures 47 and 50 where we had to cut back our budgets. And all of us individually thought, well, we're going to have to sacrifice the school liaison officers, the police officers in the school. That's what our staff are saying. This is what one of the things we had to cut back along with other social services and recreation and library. But we came together as that collaborative group and talking together. And when I say that as representatives of those organizations, it's elected representatives. And we all agreed that investing in the school liaison officers was the single most important thing that we could spend our money on. And we directed our staff to go back and find the money to fund those officers, to keep them in the school, and provide the role models and the programs that they were providing. And it happened. It happened because we exercised that political initiative, that political will, and moved forward with it. Let me just conclude by saying a couple of things. First of all, the alcohol and drug element is such a critical piece. 80% of all crime of all descriptions are in some way related directly to the use or delivery of drugs. So that's a very critical piece. And finally, perhaps just kind of a cross-cultural conclusion here, if I may. People thinking about society in relationship with youth, goes back a long time. The Greek philosopher Plutarch said that essentially you can gauge the health of a community by the way it relates to and invests in its youth. Henry Steele Kohlmeyer said that what a society does to its children will do to society. The Crow Nation believes that a family and its children are like a debris jam, a debris lodge, they call it, where the fast-flowing stream deposits these little bits of flotsam and jetsam. And it's a very fragile construction. And if you flake away a piece of that log debris, a piece of that family, it becomes dysfunctional and it washes downstream. And they consider the family to be like that logically. They have that imagery that's repeated throughout their particular folklore. So certainly there's a lot to be invested in, but it needs to be invested if, in fact, we're going to change the trend that we've been seeing, in which children have become less and less connected to the communities in which they live and less adoptive of a feeling of responsibility for those communities. And investing at the local level, I think, is in a collaborative effort, is the best strategy that we could use these scarce resources. Be happy answering questions.
Questions for the mayor.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you. I know you've been patient. We need 30 seconds more. I'm going to adjourn the public hearing for just a moment on Senate Bill 555 to do another tap hearing. I open the public hearing on Senate Bill 65. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 65. We open the public hearing on 555. And welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bryant, Judiciary Committee members. I'm Tom Schaefer. I'm from Hood River County. I am a proud parent of an Amherst College sophomore, a Hood River Valley High School junior, and a Y East middle school seventh grader. I'm also proud to be a lay community volunteer serving the Hood River County Commission on Children and Families. I have served a term as committee chair, as commission chair, vice chair, finance chair, currently serve on the Executive Committee, the Comprehensive Planning Committee, the Proposal Review Committee, and the Evaluation Committee. I am also an elected member of the Region 9 ESD Board of Directors and a member of the Hood River County School District Diversity Committee. I've also served on school district curricular committees and school site councils.
I'm advisor of Hood River Valley Leos Club, a youth project of the Lions Club. Currently working with 45 teams in Hood River County. And I just returned from a four-day weekend as a chaperone for 33 high school juniors who attended four plays in Ashland. And I am very happy to say that prior to our departure, both the head housekeeper and the owner of the motel boarded our school bus to thank our Hood River Valley High School youth for their behavior and courtesy while staying at the motel. I'm honored to be the most recent recipient of the Clare Award, Hood River County's most prestigious award for service to children and families. So I just have a few comments. Okay. I have one amendment to offer and a few comments. I hope the committee will consider the various versions of SB 555. The one amendment is related to the term limits which exist currently in 2004 for local commission members. So I'll submit that for your consideration. The comments I have are about the energy that it takes for a local commission. It's the extraordinary local energy which has made the Commission on Children and Families such a success in our local communities and a national model of local involvement. It is at the local level that the collaboration, the cooperation, the coordination has been developed with all players at the table, allowing for a reduction of redundancies, which strain resources, and allowing for the coordination of resources which allow those limited resources to be multiplied through leveraging. It's the involvement and energy of local communities which are necessary to making all of these programs a success. I have just received the Dash-3 amendments and had no time to review them carefully or take them to Hood River and share them with others on our commission. If the state, through some of the provisions for redefinitions and role revisions that I understand are included in the Dash-3 amendments, mandates more and allows less local innovation, we local community volunteers will not have the same feelings of community empowerment. The Dash-4 amendments were developed by local people from local commissions with knowledge of local conditions. And I've only received those today. I cannot comment on specifics for their contents, but I request that they be given the attention they deserve and that we at the local level have additional time to review the amendments and give full input.
Can you get back to us early next week?
I'll try to.
And the reason for doing that, as I mentioned earlier, I would like a week from Monday to bring the bill back and have a pretty good idea then of which direction I think the committee should be. So if you can get back to us next week early, that would be very good.
I'll do.
And you can write to either myself or Bill Taylor, who's the counsel on the committee.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Thank you for being patient. We have some other witnesses, and we'll call them next. And I apologize. I have to go to another meeting at this time, but believe me, I will follow your testimony closely. So Senator Courtney will take over, Chair.
Okay, Vivian Nicolage, Douglas County, Muriel Goldman from Multnomah County, Mike Simney from Harney County, would you please come forward? Also, Judy McMaston from Coos County, I would like, she could sit, maybe wait, I don't know who's, okay, you wait, okay, who did I call that didn't come forward?
Mike Sloan could not make it today. So maybe it's you need
Mike
to call. Mike Sarayan. Did you call Mike Sarayan from Harney?
Yeah, he's not here.
Okay,
then. Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay, please.
The guys aren't here. Figure out who's first.
Senator Courtney and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name for the record is Jillian Nicolaitis. I am the director of the Douglas County Commission on Children and Families. I appear before you today to express my support for improving our system for children and families so that through our communities we will reduce juvenile crime. I ask for your support of the Senate Bill 555-4 amendments before you. I have served as director of the Douglas County Commission on Children and Families since 1994 and am also a board member on the Coalition of County Children and Families Commissions. As the chief facilitator and writer of our county's comprehensive plan for children and families and our high-risk juvenile crime prevention plan, I believe that the local commission's role is paramount to achieving the goals that will reduce juvenile crime. These goals are strong families, resilient youth, effective schools, and caring communities. These are the goals the Federal Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention has articulated. By working on these key areas, research has proven that not only will we reduce the root causes of juvenile crime, but we will also reduce other societal problems such as high school dropouts, child abuse and neglect, teen pregnancy, and substance abuse. For example, you have in your packet, it's called the Fight Crime, Invest in Kids Project. It's a national research and advocacy organization comprised of law enforcement, prosecutors, and crime survivors, and it has developed a four-step program. And I present that because it gives examples of what we're doing here in Oregon. The first is prevention of child abuse and neglect through in-home parenting programs such as Healthy Start and intervention programs such as court-appointed special advocates and release nurseries. Quality educational child care and development programs such as Head Start and early childhood family resource centers. Programs that identify troubled and disruptive young school-aged children and provide children and their parents with the skills to significantly change conduct disorder and antisocial behavior, such as the First Step program designed by Hill Walker at University of Oregon's Institute on Violence and Destructive Behavior, and after-school weekend and summer youth development programs for school-aged children and teens, such as those provided through Lighted Schools. These programs span the continuum from prenatal to age 13, they're multi-stage, multi-age, and support families in a holistic way. Rather than simply targeting and fixing high-risk youth or creating an early childhood system component and a high-risk component while ignoring the 6 to 12-year-olds in between, they are community-based initiatives that involve a wide variety of partners and volunteers. They are all a part of the system for children and families that local commissions across Oregon have been developing since House Bill 2004 was passed in 1993. House Bill 2004 is a template for both the -3 and the -4 amendments. It includes a philosophical statement by the Oregon legislature that children and families should be supported and strengthened, and that decisions about the planning and management of family services and support should reside at the local level. It gives boards of county commissioners the authority to appoint local commissions which are advisory to them all on all children and families issues, and asks these plans to encompass all the services in the county. It requires communities to set up a system based on wellness, a system that is preventative, not crisis-driven, that promotes independence and family choice, and is managed and delivered to local level. House Bill 2004 envisioned a system where health, education, and social services were linked, recognizing that family dynamics are complex and interwoven. And it said that by offering supports to families, services would not be stigmatizing. In other words, we wouldn't divide the universe into broken families and healthy families and seek to fix the broken families. House Bill 2004 set up a state commission appointed by the governor with seats for both the director of the Department of Human Resources and the superintendent of public education to smooth the way for local commissions to pull the system together. No other state or local entities other than the state and local commissions are asked to take a look at the whole system, which includes juvenile child welfare, child care, informal supports, early childhood health, basic needs, and so forth. Each part of the system has dedicated professionals working hard to bring services to a specific target population, but no other entity takes that bird's-eye view. We do. In Douglas County, our local commission includes the former mayor of Roseburg, our presiding judge, the Winston School superintendent, a police chief, the deputy district attorney, a representative of the Ford Foundation, which provides millions of dollars to rural Oregon for children and families programs, a retired teacher from Sutherland, a business representative involved with the Roseburg Chamber of Commerce, a high school student from Glide, a school resource deputy from Drain, and a physical therapist. Joyce Morgan, our county commissioner, serves as liaison and actively participates in our meetings and issues. She has stated that the local commission's efforts have changed the culture in our communities. Partners are now truly understanding collaboration. The commission is the respected central body for our county. I'm sorry, central planning body for our county. We have developed a comprehensive plan that includes Healthy Start and Family Resource Centers as the top communities identified priorities. We are working with our health department to lay the foundation for Healthy Start services and anxiously await statewide funding to complement our local resources. We have developed Family Resource Centers in Reedsport and Drain and are in the process of working with the Cow Creek Tribe in Canyonville to develop a Family Resource Center there. Glide and Sutherland are also working with the commission to develop family resource centers. When the governor's office sent out the planning instructions for the high-risk juvenile crime prevention plan last July with a two-month turnaround, our county commissioners made the decision that our high-risk plan needs to be a component of the county's broader comprehensive plan and that the Commission on Children and Families would take the lead in establishing the planning framework and pulling the partners together. We spent an intensive 2 months in work groups led by our SDF branch manager, our ESD integration specialist, our health department director, and our county sheriff. Our state representative, Jeff Cruz, was also an active member of the planning team. In addition to juvenile department basic services, we developed a prevention plan that focused on 4th through 6th graders because we saw that as our local need. We also relied heavily on local input gathered at the Douglas County Juvenile Justice Summit held last April, which the commission spearheaded. Over 260 citizens participated in that summit. Last week, we also did a prevention summit where about 250 citizens came to discuss the continuum for prevention for 0 to 18. The Dash 4 amendments will support our working communities by doing the following. First, it acknowledges that communities provide the context for healthy children and families and that strong families and healthy communities are interdependent. And that would be on page 1 of the Dash 4, lines 23 and 24. We have found that much of our work involves pulling together volunteers, parents, business people, and others outside the traditional social service and education systems. We believe this is where energy and resources are abundant. Secondly, we believe in bringing education to the table by removing the language in current law that services for children and families does not include those services provided by the Department of Education, which is on page 3, lines 13 to 15 of the Dash 4s. We believe that in order for our work to be successful, education is an integral part of the system. We welcome forging stronger links with schools and early childhood education services. Thirdly, we believe in retaining the State Commission on Children and Families authority to review and approve or deny local comprehensive plans, which is on page 6, lines 7 and 8. We have worked hard to develop a partnership with the State Commission, and we appreciate their bottom-up approach. We believe that participation with all the relevant state agencies, housing, education, economic development, OIA, etc., is critical to our work. However, we also believe that that such cooperation should occur through the State Commission and that we should have to deal with only one entity when it comes to plan review and approval. Another point would be retaining the local commission's authority to develop and prepare the local comprehensive plans for all services in the community. That would be page 13, lines 8 through 16, dash 4 amendments. While we certainly support and promote state and local coordination and collaboration, we are concerned that by creating a system where everyone is in charge, we will de facto create a system where nobody is in charge of the local planning process. Someone has to call the meeting, someone has to write and submit the plan. Our experience has been that someone is us, the local commissions. We have had some difficulties since 1993 bringing all the partners to the table. Many times, the reluctant entities have questioned whether local commissions have the authority to ask a particular part of the system to participate in the planning process. The Dash 3 amendments weaken our legitimacy in pulling all the parties together. The Dash 4 amendments do not. And fifth, I think I have one more point, and then I'll summarize. Bringing needed data to support the local planning process is section 16, pages 18 and 19. We applaud the governor's efforts to encourage state agencies to better support the local planning process. Getting current data and budget information about our counties and communities has frequently been a challenge. We ask the committee to assure that the state agencies are providing demographic and service delivery data that is necessary for us to do an accurate and timely review of the system. The Dash 4 amendments delete a number of proposals found in the Dash 3 amendments. For the most part, these are areas where we believe the current law has worked well for us, and we support retaining current statutory language. Section 12 of the Dash 3 amendments eliminates the Healthy Start program from statute and establishes a statewide early childhood home visitation system. As commissions, we strongly support Healthy Start and would oppose any changes to the current law. We are in the process of working with the governor's office on the Early Childhood Initiative, but have not had the opportunity to see a finished product. We would rather continue this effort during the interim and bring your product that we can all support during the next legislative session. We did not include a juvenile crime prevention continuum in the Dash 4 amendments. However, Douglas County would be supportive of adding language that includes family resource centers, relief nurseries, First Step, and CASA. I appreciate this opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 555-4, and we look forward to working with the legislative process, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Muriel Goldman.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak on Senate Bill 555-3. For the record, my name is Muriel Goldman, and I'm a lay member of the Multnomah County Commission on Children and Families. I just learned early this morning that our Board of County Commissioners had voted on a resolution on this bill and endorsing it. primarily they were looking at the juvenile justice piece, which I certainly endorse, the alcohol and drug piece, and the early childhood or healthy start piece, whichever one you want to call it. What I want to speak to are the amendments on the role of the state and local commissions. We heard, as Jillian said, the quick turnaround in various amendments coming from the governor's office, as well as others who submitted it, hasn't given local commissions really an opportunity to review it. I happen to have been following it because I testified on 2268 in the House, and we were opposed to that. We had a lot of concerns about it. And so I've been following it. I've also honored with the opportunity to have input into the bill that was being developed through the governor's office. And I appreciate the suggested changes in the 553 that were incorporated at my suggestion. However, and I also appreciate the interest in improved coordination. As a longtime child advocate, this is an area that I've advocated for a long time. So it's not an either or, but there's still a perception out in the community that, in spite of what's being said, that the local commission's role would be designated more to coordinating comprehensive plan and moving away from what you've been hearing from the other local commissions. We, in our commission, we do focus on hazardous use, but we also focus on mobilizing the community, and we think that's where our greatest strength is. And we believe that unless members of the community feel like they are involved in the planning and the decision-making and actually help in shaping what we need to be doing in our community, that we will never have the support that we all need for our children and families. They will begin to look. We still hear people who say kids are a pain, they're a drain on the taxpayers. We want them to say that children and families are our most important asset. We have to do everything we can to provide the supports they need. And that's really what the commissions at the local level are about, mobilizing communities. And we're beginning to see that pay off. We have our membership on our commission consists of people who represent a whole bunch of different kinds of constituencies. And they take back what we have identified as critical issues, or take the time, which is the asset building, strength building, that's based on research that was done out of Minneapolis and the Research Institute and our own research in our own communities. They're taking that back to their constituencies. And they're incorporating what we have helped design into their networks. And that's what we're all about, is getting everybody out there, whether it's the business community or the faith community, or neighborhoods, or parents, or individuals living next door to people with kids is doing that. And so with that, I just want to go on to what you have in front of you, which is suggesting some amendments to Senate Bill 55-3. As I said, we're not about services, we're about outcomes. And we sometimes employ services to bring about outcomes, but we also use other methods, mass public communication, advocacy, organizing within ethnic communities, the faith communities, and the business communities. We have identified where we can develop new financial resources through corporate partners and system-wide technology improvements. But we would like to recognize that, make sure that Senate Bill 555 fully recognizes this for all commissions. We want you to ensure that this bill recognizes the extraordinary opportunities that local commissions are realizing. And we have three simple suggestions that would help do this and approve the -3 amended Senate Bill 555. If you look at Section 9, which is on page 14, lines 4 to 10, in this version of the bill, that section is deleted. We are suggesting that you retain the first sentence and amend the second sentence so that it no longer talks about a service delivery plan, but instead refers to a comprehensive strategic plan for achieving locally determined outcomes in coordination with statewide goals and outcomes, including the Oregon benchmark. It doesn't take away from the coordination effort, but it does acknowledge that there are other things out there that we need to be doing to get our community involved in supporting it. And then you would delete the third sentence. On Section 9, page 16, line 15, we would suggest that you amend it so that it no longer talks about a system of services, but instead a statewide system of formal and informal services and supports. And Finally, please assure that local commissions never lose the role of being implementers of locally developed plans. This is the very heart of our power, and we're concerned about the risk of becoming merely an administrative body, planning body that takes no action. In order to keep volunteers who are the people who serve on the commissions interested, they have to feel that they are actually out there doing things in the community and mobilizing the community to carry out what the community feels is important in that particular community. Just pulling together a coordinated comprehensive plan of services is merely a technical job. It takes a lot of work, by the way, and most of the commissions in this state depend on state dollars for their staffing. Some counties, like Multnomah County, helped us with that. But even in Multnomah County, the way it is addressed, it would take so much time for our staff to do the service coordination piece without technical assistance from the state commission and the other partners who would be part of this planning process, that there would be no time left for us to do the other kinds of things we have to do. So thank you very much. I appreciate your listening to me.
Good afternoon, Senator Courtney and my Honorable Senator Tarno, Senator Burdick. It's my pleasure to be here. My name is Judy McNathan. I'm the director of the Coos County Commission on Children and Families, and I served in that position for 5 years. Prior to that, I had 15 long years of volunteer service through the Juvenile Services Commission and then the Commission on Children and Youth. So you see before you 20 years of experience in the evolution of the commission system. I was able to participate in the meeting on Monday where several directors for the first time were able to discuss Senate Bill 555. And because of the calendar, if you will, I was lucky enough to have a commission meeting on Wednesday. Actually, we had a meeting on Wednesday and last night as well. And so our legislative committee did have an opportunity to review the first draft. Based on that, my local committee voted to request your approval of 555 with the dash fours. That's our understanding that the dash fours, the only differences in the dash fours are basically with the commission system, that the alcohol and drug and the juvenile crime are both things that we're very supportive of. Not too long ago before state commission meetings, my peers gave me the assignment of speaking to the state commission on the phrase, do no harm. And I think my local commission would agree that in looking at that part of the bill that deals with local commissions, that they would recommend that you do no harm to the work that we are able to do at the local level. And I brought visuals to show you some of that work. It deals with 0 through 18. We try to look at issues that relate to children all through their lives. So the first one I have for you is the blue one that is about the new brain research. It was, the commission took care of the printing but it was written and sponsored by a coalition of groups that you'll see on the back page. That's the work we do, bringing people like that together to educate the community. The second one is the sponsors of that are on the back page. It's about break the silence, stop the violence. And this group of people, which happen to be our local tribes and the commission and the lip sync, all sponsored the purchase of these and also helped with a violence prevention conference that 200 people attended just April 8th in Coos County, which we thought was very timely because they got a lot of information about safe schools, and not just safe schools, but also safe agencies, safe stores, and because what happens in our schools, tragically, could happen in other types of organizations as well. So finally, a last collaboration that we're very proud of that this commission does is about our teams and what they're saying to us. So I hope you'll have time to look at that to understand that we are a comprehensive planning group as well as a comprehensive working group. We don't need more legislation, frankly. We're going to do this because it's what we do. So Again, I ask your support of the 555 and the Dash 4 to do no harm to the work that we do, in fact, to support us in continuing that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions or comments? Thank you very much for your patience. It's a long afternoon. Appreciate that so much.
Thank you for inviting me, even though I don't live quite 100 miles away, but with all the traffic jams, that sometimes seems like it's more than 100 miles away.
Diane Treadway, please. Is she here? Okay, Diane, some magic. And then is Chief Youngbar here? Yes. You step forward, please. And then I'm going to ask Rich Peppers to come forward, please. There you go. Diane's all the way over from Madras. Do you want to go first? You've been very patient. I'm sorry the afternoon's gone on so long.
Thank you, Senator Courtney, and members of the committee. My name is Diane Treadway. I'm the Executive Director of the Commission on Children and Families in Jefferson County. I brought with me today my daughter, Amanda Treadway, who's on her way to the Boys and Girls Club in Corvallis to participate in a state games tournament. We were here, and I'm happy to be here today. I am going to be very brief, and I promise that I will, because several of my colleagues have touched on several points today that I am not willing to go over again. But one of the things that I do want to mention to you is that I did have an opportunity on Monday to work with a group of my peers to look at making amendments to the Dash 2 version of this bill. And of course, since then there were other amendments and only minutes to look at them today before this hearing. This bill from the get-go, even in its original form in House Bill 2268, literally took on a life of its own and got some feet, and changes are being made as fast as we can pull these things off the printer. In consideration of the work that we did on Monday and the discussions that I have been able to have with my local commission members, we are supportive of the Dash 4 amendment. I am concerned, though, that what you have before you today, it originally started out as a two-page bill, and at its peak, I think it ended up with 36 pages. And I'm not here in any means or any way to insult anybody's intelligence, but more so to commend you for your patience today and suggest that this bill does contain a lot of information, a lot of changes, and a lot of things in it that will affect several agencies and several very important partners in this whole thing. It is important for you to understand that the Jefferson County Commission on Children and Families and the Board of County Commissioners solely support the governor's efforts to reduce juvenile crime and strengthening supports at the community level to serve high-risk youth. Our concern, however, is that although I'm not certain that it was the intent of the governor's office, that some of the language in the Dash 3 amendment still focuses very much on the high-risk youth, and we want to make sure that we're looking at the entire community and all the kids and families in the community. My recommendation today, Senator Courtney and members of the committee, would be that you look at the possibility, or may I suggest, that an interim committee be formed. Obviously, there are a lot of parties subject to this 36-page or 31-page bill, and local commissions would very much like to be at the table should you or Senator Bryant call an interim committee together. But I do believe that we are moving in the right direction, and I think that our vision is the same. There's a couple of glitches I think that we need to work through, and that would be my recommendation. I would hope that local commissions on children and families could be a party to any type of work that's done now. And an interim committee would probably be the best way to go about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Okay, just so you know, I'm a big fan of Boys and Girls Club. I've coached the Salem here for 10 years, so I'm a big fan of Boys and Girls Club. So thank you for your patience. I noticed you came from Madras.
I'm sorry you had to wait so long. I don't want anybody to think that because other members aren't here that we aren't carefully paying attention to the record. We are, and people had to leave for different reasons, so hope you understand that. If you want to be excused, you can. If you got to go with to do your thing, you can be excused.
Amanda hasn't had lunch yet today.
That's right. I really feel bad about
that. No, that's all right.
So,
okay.
So if you want to get something, sure, go ahead.
We have to practice our pool game anyway.
I'm going to say that she plays basketball, one of those sports. She's going to have an advantage, I think, and I won't go into why. But anyway, so thank you very much for waiting so long. You can
thank
you,
Senator Carnell.
Appreciate that very much. Okay, I think the police chief from Lake Oswego. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, it is.
That's 100 miles away, but with the tremendous traffic situation now that you have an I-5, which is another committee in the building, transportation, which I won't get into that war, you may be taking a long while to get home. Anyway, I shouldn't be so smiling. So, Chief, your comments, please.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Les Youngbar. I'm the police chief of Lake Oswego. I come here today wearing about 2.5 hats. I guess I'll get the half of one off right away. It's in an unprecedented move, the state sheriff's representative had to leave and ask that I represent him. He just wanted to let the committee know that the Sheriff's Association is in support of this bill, and I believe probably for the same reasons that the Chief's Association is, which I will mention. I'm also a member, a law enforcement member of the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee, and as a member of that committee, I support the amendment, the -3 amendments, and particularly the juvenile crime prevention package, which I think is critical and have had probably as much opportunity as any of my colleagues to experience the legislation. And I think it's a great piece of legislation. The Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, of which I'm the president of this year, supports this legislation. We believe that it's imperative to have a continuum of services that's coordinated, particularly at this opportunity to coordinate at the local and regional level, and that contrary to some of the testimony as a street police officer, I do believe that people can be turned around when they're even in high school, and I've seen it happen. I've participated in that. So by having the continuum, which I would agree from early childhood or even prenatal in some cases, all the way through is very critical. And I think we need services at all in all areas. And that's pretty much our position. Thank you.
Thank you. Your patience. Any questions? If you want, you don't have to wait either because, again, it's a traffic thing.
I
appreciate you being so patient. Before I go to Rich Pepper's, is Kathy Osborne? Is she here? Kathy, why don't you come up? And then also Russ Spence. Is Russ still around? Oh, you took his place. I'm sorry. That's what I should say. Okay. I can just... Then how about Katie Riley? Is she here? Katie, why don't you come on up? See, I'm kind of... It's Friday afternoon. I know you're all... Get Nancy. Been very patient. Rich, you're first, and then go to Kathy. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Rich Peppers with the Oregon Public Employees Union. We represent people in many different agencies, state and local level, who are doing the kind of work that's affected by Senate Bill 555, that's involved in Senate Bill 555. And OPEU has also been part of the debate around House Bill 2004 since its inception in the 93 session and every session after that. So why ruin the good thing? Here we are again. we wanted to just let the committee know that OPEU supports the Senate Bill 555 and -3 amendments. We've, from the beginning, always supported the idea of collaboration and coordination at the local level, and we believe the -3 amendments not only allow that, but encourage that, and that's one of our reasons for supporting the -3 amendments. We hope that the committee will entertain the -3 amendments, and that's just about all I have to tell you.
All right. Any questions for Rich? Rich, you can be excused too, because I can notice how I do this. I don't make anybody stay school after school. Although it's after school already. Kathy, do you want to tell us about the Juvenile Project position on this, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne from the Juvenile Rights Project. I'm also speaking today on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, since I am a member of them, and as a juvenile criminal defense lawyer, out there in the real world for the past 9 years. That's what I've been doing, and I like that job. I decided it's a lot easier than this one. A lot of people cynical in the world might wonder why criminal defense lawyers are supporting the Senate Bill 555, the -3 amendments on juvenile crime prevention. Certainly, many members of the public see criminal defense lawyers as wanting to have crime increase, because that certainly would be a full employment bill for us. However, I would like nothing better to be able to put a gone fishing sign on my office door and be able to take a long, long, long vacation and have to find another job. It would make me happy, because the reason I do this work as a juvenile criminal defense lawyer is because I care about my clients. Quite honestly, I don't care about the politics. It makes me disgusted that we have to sit here and pass legislation that says, all of you out there that are working on for the best interest of the children, cooperate. All of you out there that are working in the best interest of the children, coordinate your services. To me, that just seems like common sense. And I just find it frustrating that we also sit here and argue about who's going to have control. Because let me tell you, I know from experience, in the entire time that we've been sitting here in this hearing, there have been judges that wanted to put children into drug and alcohol treatment, and they didn't have the spaces. There have been judges that have wanted to put children into detention beds because the children needed to be calmed down and held on to for a while so we could get their attention, and they didn't have the beds. There have been judges out there who have had serious juvenile violent kids put in front of them that haven't had the programs that they need. And to sit and talk about putting together an interim committee to discuss who should be in control of this money is the wrong thing to do. It just is wrong. The kids need the money, and the kids need the money right now. The whole nature of kidhood and childhood is that these kids keep getting older every single day. I've represented kids for 9 years, the same child, and I've been the one adult in their life that has been there for 9 years. That's just wrong. It's wrong that a criminal defense lawyer is the one person that has followed that child through for the past 9 years. But that's the reality of our situation that we have here. I guess the only thing that the Juvenile Rights Project and the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association would urge you to do is to do the right thing and pass this bill and get the money out to where it's needed, and that's to the kids. I also have to respectfully disagree with Senator Durfler. Changes can be made in 11 to 17-year-olds. Those are the kids I represent. I don't represent the younger kids, although other people in my office do. My specialization is the delinquent kids, and that, therefore I represent the 11 to 17-year-olds. And I can tell you by the number of cards that I get at holiday time of kids who I've formerly represented who tell me about their lives, about their families, about the colleges that they're attending, about the jobs that they're doing, that we can make a difference in these kids' lives. And I certainly don't ever want to be put into a situation where I have to look at a 12-year-old and say, you know, we know what we can do to help you so that you're no longer committing delinquent acts, but we don't care enough about you to give you the money or have those programs available to you. So we just decided that we're going to throw your generation away because we're going to we're going to look at the 0 to 3-year-olds. Certainly it's important to look at the 0 to 3-year-olds, but don't throw those 12-year-olds away. They can be changed, and they deserve to be changed, and we deserve to give them the opportunity to change. Thank you. I'm available for questions.
Mr. Chair. I didn't realize Kathy was that passionate. I hope you wait for a while before you hang your shingle out going fishing. We need you around. Okay.
Thank you, Senator Tarnow. I do have to say that I had the opportunity to attend the Jerry Spence Trial Lawyers College, and one of the things that Jerry taught us is it's no good to throw a $1,000 saddle on a $10 horse. It's better to throw a $10 saddle on a $1,000 horse.
Okay,
May I leave?
Yes, you may. You going to leave on a horse or what? Thank you very much. Yes, please.
A tough person to follow. For the record, my name is Catherine Katie Riley, and I'm pleased to speak with you, Senator Courtney, and other members of the committee. I am here representing today the Oregon Public Health Association's Adolescent Risky Behavior Task Force, and I believe most of the people in the legislature have gotten copies of our report that we did this past year. We are here today supporting Senate Bill 555-3 because it embodies many of the elements that we recommended in our report, and that includes the local development of comprehensive plans through the mechanism of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. And that it includes elements such as development of these comprehensive plans, coordinated activities with local groups as well as state agencies, implementing research-based activities, focusing on high-risk youth to prevent juvenile delinquency. And I will say here, too, that research has shown that, contrary to Dr. Brazelton's conclusion that he can predict somebody at the age of 18 months, we often find that many youth who are, quote-unquote, good kids get into trouble during adolescence because it's a very impulsive time and they're going through a lot of changes. And so I think that we do need the continuum of services, not just to early childhood, but we... Early childhood is extremely important as well. And then finally, the bill also includes the evaluation component, which is extremely important in order to move forward with improving the services and the programs that we have. And that concludes my testimony. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Those are all the witnesses that we have signed up. Actually we had two others who are signed up, but they've chosen, I guess it's Mark and Karen, I guess they want to testify today. So, well, I'd like to, it's been a long afternoon, I realize most people have come and gone, and we are going to, I guess, start to work the bill on Monday. Is it?
Mr. Chairman, the committee, the next hearing on this bill will be a week from Monday.
A week from this coming Monday.
Right. Mr. Hill Walker will be here to lead off the hearing.
Thank you very much for that. I close to the public hearing on Senate Bill 555, and we are adjourned.
You get cold in here, Peter?
I got a little cold.
Yeah, it cranked up the air conditioning.
Yeah, I got. I didn't know.